The History Things podcast is brought to you by HistoryNet, publisher of 9 different historical magazines, including The Civil War Times, American History, and Military History. Visit HistoryNet.com to learn more or follow them on social media by searching for @history_net. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to the History Things podcast. I'm Matt Borders, and with me, as always, is my co-host, the man out in Western Maryland,
the sheriff,
Pat McGuire.
What's happening, everybody? I didn't mean to throw you there, buddy.
You did, just a touch.
That's probably the first time in the history of the show I've got you mid-intro.
Mid-intro,
I'm
yes,
getting good
indeed.
At this by season 5 now, dude.
Well, and that's a good point, Pat. We are now just starting into season 5. We've already had one show, and now we're hitting you folks with the next. Our first show for season 5 dealt with the cold country.
Yeah, it was a good way to get started on a frosty day. You know, when you're chilly, throw some coals in there and heat up. And we went to Pennsylvania cold country specifically.
That's
sorry,
right.
West Virginia, you missed out on this story time. And we hung out with Jake Wynn, right?
Mm-hmm.
Good friend of ours.
That's exactly right. And Jake mentioned the Civil War history of coal country and the really disparate and varied reaction to the war and how the folks there were either wanting to or not wanting to be involved.
I was going to say feeling it or not feeling it.
Right.
Yeah.
But we do have a very famous unit, at least one, and one that I think that comes to most folks' mind when they think of Pennsylvania coal country. Again, almost botched it.
You're going to botch it 100 times. In this episode, apologize now, Matt. You're going to botch it 100 times.
I'm going to botch coal country.
He's
I apologize.
Botch it.
But our guest today is an old friend of mine, actually from the Antietam days. John, you and I never got to work with each other. This is John Hoptek, ladies and gentlemen, one of the
legendary
great
John
Rangers.
Hoptek, for those who don't know, John, welcome to the History Things podcast, friend.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here and happier still to be talking amongst friends about the 48th Pennsylvania.
Yeah,
man. Yeah.
Coal country.
He nails it in one. I've been bouncing all over.
This is why when we talk about Rushmores, he's on it, and we're just at the bottom watching, because he can say coal country, and
true.
You and I trip over it in the basement. I was thinking about, here's how ingrained the unit we're going to talk about today is in my mind, how synonymous with coal they are, John. When I think about masonry, I immediately think about the 48th Pennsylvania. Why? Because at my fort, the two laborers we talk about in its construction are the masons and the miners. And as soon as I say the word miners in my interpretation, my brain immediately goes crater, 48th Pennsylvania.
Yep.
And just boom, right? And it's like that association growing up, maybe just as a Civil War guy, but if you say miner or because of my job masonry, my brain thinks of those two together, and I immediately think about this unit. So I probably lost all of our listeners with that. They're like, what the hell is happening right now? But who cares? So
John, you are one of the, if I can be so bold, one of the legends in our community for Civil War history. You've done some fantastic work at Antietam, and that's where we met so many years ago. And you've continued with the National Park Service. We don't have to name names,
please,
but you
name
are one of the great names.
Good.
And a ranger that I've really admired for a lot of years. We're just happy as punch to have you here on the show to talk about a topic that you have written on and know a heck of a lot about.
Well, thank you, Matt. That's awful kind, and really, that is too much. I do remember my Antietam days very fondly.
Absolutely.
And, I was there from 2005 until 2014, so hard for me to believe it's been 10 years since I last worked down there, and I can't imagine, you know, I live near Gettysburg. I made that drive every day.
As we talked about.
I don't know how I did that.
In pre-production, we talked about it. It's bittersweet that your very last day at Antietam was the very first time I ever met you.
Is that right?
Yeah. I had the
March
pleasure.
March 22nd, 2014, I think the day was.
Yeah.
I could be mistaken about
no,
that.
No, actually, but, so yeah. Not the very first time I met you. The very first time I met you was probably, actually, when did I met you on your Arrowhead day.
Right.
When was that? Was that?
I think it was anniversary.
So were you
that
already at Gettysburg
right.
and
I
you
was.
Came back for
yeah.
that? So I actually
yeah.
met you after you left the battlefield.
Well, yeah. That's I came crazy. Back for an anniversary.
So I said it out loud. So by the way, Matt, we have to be top secret about certain sites that certain people work at, but I guess you're famous enough that everybody knows where you work. So, Antietam is one of these stories that Matt and I are passionate about. So meeting you there and experiencing, honestly, you can be very humble, and that is okay, sir. We are like Wayne and Garth in Wayne's World. We're not worthy. We recognize it. But we're appreciative because it's guys like you that we learn from.
Right.
And that's you're one of the people that helped inspire a lot of what I do now in terms of interpretation in my own job as a ranger. So thank you for that. And it was cool to kind of interact with you at such a special place to us as Antietam. Was the 48th Pennsylvania at Antietam?
Oh, they sure were. And, you know, one of the biggest for myself, I grew up in coal country.
There you go.
That was going to be another question
south
we had.
Of coal country. I grew up in a small town called Orwigsburg. It's about 8 miles south of Pottsville, the seat of government for Schuylkill County. But about Antietam is there are two Union officers depicted on monuments there, and they are both from Schuylkill County.
Oh, yeah.
Benjamin Crist of the 50th Pennsylvania, and just a short distance away is James Noggle of the 48th. So, yes, indeed, the 48th Pennsylvania were there. They were with the 9th Army Corps, as was the 50th. And the 9th Army Corps is a topic of utter fascination to me. You know,
absolutely.
Working at that other battlefield park up the road, I don't get to talk much 9th Army Corps.
Good
so
point.
That's why I appreciate coming in here and doing so. And you talked about, were they at Antietam? They were. They were engaged in the fight for the bridge. With Noggle's brigade and then helping to turn back A.P. Hill's attack later on.
All right.
They suffered pretty heavily there. I think they suffered north of 60 casualties, and it was on the battlefield of Antietam where James Noggle, who I've studied for most of my life, literally received his commission to Brigadier General.
Wow. Mm.
So he had been recommended for promotion by Jesse Reno in the aftermath of Second Bull Run. And Reno, of course, met his end at South Mountain.
I was going to say, good thing he got that in.
Right, yeah. So he wrote to Lincoln, and Lincoln got it approved, and the commission arrived, and he received it on September 19th on the field there at Antietam.
Man.
So, wow.
I think that's why when the 48th Pennsylvania, they wanted, you know, to place a monument at Antietam in 1904, they placed a bronze statue of Noggle on top.
So. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited to get into this because we spent, you know, in January with Jake talking about what was happening in the coal country, you know, and this is one of the units that is obviously very connected to that, but is known out on the battlefields in a sort of dual capacity. They're good fighters.
Absolutely.
But, like, the thing I think they're most known for is the digging of the mine at Petersburg. So it's like you get the who they are at home on the front kind of experience. So, Matt, do you have any other questions? John, do you want to tell us a little bit about what you used to do, or do you just want to get into this? Like, I'm off the rails already, everybody! Where do you want to go from here? Do you want to do some more background?
Well, I definitely want to do some more background, because we don't want to jump necessarily right into the fight. And so, John, can you tell us a little bit, especially because it dovetails so well with our first chat with Jake, how does the 48th comes out, like you said, out of coal country. Mm-hmm. Is it an enthusiastic enlistment? Take us back to the beginning of the unit.
Yes. Well, the 48th Pennsylvania was organized beginning early August and into September of 1861. Mm. But the origins of this particular regiment lie with the Washington Artillery. In Pottsville, in Schuylkill County, there were a number of militia units. In the 1830s, it was the National Light Infantry.
Mm.
And the National Light Infantry was one of the premier militia units of the pre-war era. And in 1842, 20-year-old James Noggle organized a militia company of his own.
Mm.
So apparently he was swimming in Tumbling Run Reservoir with a number of other of his friends, 18, 19, 20 years old, and they began doing kind of calisthenic swimming, and they thought to themselves, you know, we ought to form a militia company. Why not, right?
As one does.
At the age of 20, he organized what became the Washington Artillery, and he was very, very dedicated to this unit, and he took it very seriously. Of course, we know pre-Civil War militia units varied wildly in terms of efficiency and drill, but he was determined to make this a premier militia unit, and he had no military background, no experience. Again, he was 20 years old when he founded this company. He was a wallpaper hanger by trade. He was a house painter, but he did this kind of on the side.
Sure.
In addition to, And in 1846, he applied. He responded to the call to arms for the Mexican-American War.
Mm-hmm.
And initially, he was turned down because the thought was, well, Pennsylvania doesn't need to furnish any units. But by 1847, Pennsylvania was tasked with raising two regiments of volunteers. And his company, the Washington Artillery, became Company B of the 1st Pennsylvania Volunteer Infantry, which he subsequently led in Mexico. So under Scott, he served from Veracruz to the capture of Mexico City.
Oh, he's really in it then.
Oh, yeah, he is. Oh, yeah. He is very much in it. So he is there engaged with this militia company and returned to a hero's response, a hero's reception, if you will, from the people of Pottsville. And the Whigs of Pottsville began, you know, of course, a local military hero. He was being recruited from various political factions to run for small offices in Schuylkill County. And the Whigs presented him with this intricate sword, which is the one that is on the monument in Antietam. Mm-hmm. It's not a Civil War saber or sword. It's the one he was given upon his return from Mexico. So he continued with this unit until the outbreak of Civil War. And by this point, Governor Curtin is well aware of the state's best militia units and the Washington Artillery early on tendered their services in the event of war. Hmm. By this point, though, the captain of the Washington Artillery was James Wren. And on April 18th of 1861, Captain Wren led the Washington Artillery along with four other militia units through Baltimore. They shed the first blood of the war. This is 24 hours in advance of the 6th Massachusetts. And they arrive in Washington, D.C. that evening.
It's a new
so this is the first defenders.
These are the first defenders.
Wonderful.
Yeah, so the Washington Artillery is one of the five first defender companies. And James Wren is going to lead that company throughout the 90 days of their term of service. End of July, they're mustered out, and Governor Curtin commissioned Noggle to raise and recruit a three-year regimen. So Noggle decided he is going to raise this unit entirely from Schuylkill County. His Washington Artillery under Captain Wren became Company B.
So he's got to go to his boys.
A built-in company already. So he determined to raise this unit solely from Schuylkill County. And of the 10 companies, five of them came from Pottsville, the seat of government.
Wow.
And not Pottstown. Now, a lot of people get those two confused. Sure. But Pottsville, Schuylkill County, five of the 10 units come from there. Other units come from the surrounding coal townships and farming districts of southern Schuylkill. So August, September, they're organized. They march off to war, and Governor Curtin presents them with a flag. And in the canton of the flag, it says, "In the cause of the Union, we know no such word as fail."
That's a good one.
That's a good tone from the top. Question for you real fast. Before we move into August, September, and getting into the war, 90-day service term enlistment ends in end of July.
Right.
Does the Washington Artillery go down, form Manassas?
They do not. They are.
So they stay in Pennsylvania?
They actually stay in Washington. They,
sorry, I don't know why I meant Pennsylvania. Yeah. I meant Washington.
They arrive, you know, very dramatically. They arrive in Washington, D.C., 7 p.m., April 18th. Irvin McDowell meets them at the train station.
Like April 18th.
Yep. Wow. And he escorts them to their headquarters, their quarters, which is the U.S. Capitol building.
Uh-huh.
So now these fellas are being stationed in the halls of Congress, literally, occupying the vice president's chambers, the House of Representatives, and they spent the entirety of their three-month service in the Capitol, but especially at Fort Washington. So they thought they were getting overlooked entirely. They were the first to arrive.
They
should have been the first Pennsylvania Volunteer Infantry.
Yeah.
But instead, these units, those five first defender units, are parceled out to the arsenal, the Navy Yard, Fort Washington, and they're kind of scattered while Irvin McDowell's army takes the field.
Ew.
So they were supposed to be mustered out July 18th because of their 90-day service ending on that day. But they would remain through the emergency. A lot of people thought Washington will be attacked now after Bull Run. So they remained at Fort Washington until they got home. So a lot of those first defenders would reenlist. And James Wren, captain of Company B, he went on to become major of the 48th Pennsylvania. John Michael Priest edited a book, James Wren's Diary, which tells his story. But he's only with the unit through early 63. And, you know, I always enjoy telling the story of the 48th because, like you said, they're known for the crater. The crater. Hey, those were the guys who dug the crater. Right. Yep. Boy, they had an extensive war record prior to that and after that as well.
Excellent.
So let's get into it. When is the first time they will see the elephant? Like the first time that they are, you know, they're formed, they're trained, they're reenlisted, they're all back. It's go time, right? We are into the war. Is it Peninsula? Is it on to Richmond?
It is not. No, okay. These fellas actually, you know, these coal miners and these coal laborers from Schuylkill County make their way first to Fortress Monroe.
We're going to get to Schuylkill. We'll get to Schuylkill later. We'll address that because I dated a Pennsylvania girl for a long time, and I had my own education in this. Mm-hmm. And as somebody who is now hip, I feel a lot of people need to get hip because it's like in my immediate community, it's like I know it, you know it, and like Jake Wynn knows it, and then everybody else is like, how the hell do you say that? Like, what is that? Schuylkill? Yeah, it's a whole lot. So we'll get into that.
Sure. So they are mustered into service, and they set off for Fort Monroe. All right. And they're at Fort Monroe for a matter of weeks, and Noggle is their colonel. So James Noggle and his four brothers are all in this unit.
Wow.
So the entire Noggle family are serving as officers, of course, in the 48th, except for his brother Levi and Abraham. They're musicians. But James Noggle is
determined. I love their band.
Yeah, he wants to make this a proficient unit. He wants to make this a well-trained, well-disciplined unit, and he does succeed. They become very, very good. They're at Fortress Monroe, and they begin to hear rumors that they are going to be heading south to North Carolina.
All right.
Because there's a unit down there that's having a tough go of it, and that's the 20th Indiana.
Where we're going. We're going to the Burnside Expedition!
The 20th Indiana was assigned to Hatteras Inlet, and these Indianans are wondering why had they ended up there all the way from Indiana, right?
Oh, man, dude. I love the Hatteras story. Having such a family connection to the Cape Hatteras. I have a 252 telephone number. Very directly. Like, it's part of our family, and I always like to give some friends at Fredericksburg and our colleague Avery a ton of crap over the amount of times we incorrectly claim such and such as the first time a beachhead was established or it was a joint operation. And it's like, I was like, you know what? Silas Stringham and I think it's Butler in 1861 definitely went ashore in Hatteras before Fredericksburg. So, oh man, just getting a little shout out to the Cape Hatteras.
So in November of 1861, they receive orders that their next destination is Hatteras, North Carolina. And I only imagine what these fellas thought. I mean, there were a good number of soldiers who had immigrated from Ireland, from Germany, of course, familiar with the waters, but a good many probably this is the first time they're accustomed to or seeing life on the water.
Yeah.
And a number of them, of course, got seasick on the way down from Monroe to Hatteras, and the hope was this would be a short stint, right?
Nope.
I mean, who wants to camp out on the beach in the wintertime with the wind and all that? And several times the tide took away their camp. I mean, they established camp on the beach.
Dude, that area is miserable in the winter. The winds rise up. Like, a hurricane season hits that place into, like, late November. But then you get the gales that come after it, tides. I mean, the Outer Banks is a living island, both the sand itself and the storms. Yeah. I can't even imagine being on a Civil War encampment out in the open on the beach.
Right.
Ugh.
And there they stayed until March of 1862. So from November of 61 through the winter, their first Christmas is on the beaches of Hatteras. And then in March, of course, Burnside begins to really go after it, if you will. And Roanoke and the 48th is attached to Reno's command of Burnside's Expeditionary Force. And again, this is the origins of the 9th Army Corps, along with Stevens Division in South Carolina. So their first battle honors, the first name they got to put on their banner, their flag, was New Bern.
Hey-o!
Yeah, even though they did not pull a trigger at New Bern. their role in that battle was literally carrying boxes of ammunition.
We were there, though. Listen, we were there. Yeah.
So they their first battle experience, quote-unquote, was bringing up crate after crate after crate of ammunition to support the Burnside's men at New Bern.
I mean, critical function,
absolutely,
though.
Absolutely. Right? And Burnside thought so. In fact, it was he who instructed them to put New Bern on their battle flags. So
that's awesome.
The 48th, you know, I think any unit that served with Burnside, they liked the guy. I mean, he was very much liked by his soldiers, you know, and he took care of their needs. He took care of their wants. So they are engaged at New Bern, and then they get reassigned to New Bern, and there they stay until July of 62, and then they are sent with Burnside's forces to the peninsula. Not in time. But they will be heading north rapidly.
On the way home, so to speak.
As Lee and Jackson are making their way north to confront Pope in Northern Virginia, Burnside's command is also racing their way up. And their first battle action, major battle action, is Second Bull Run.
And this is
the first time the unit is involved in a major battle action. And as it would turn out, in terms of numbers lost, it was their worst battle. In terms of casualties. Unless we discount Petersburg, of course, as a 9-month-long fight.
Well, look, then let's just say the obvious. Yeah. It's good to get that out of the way. You know, that shows that you're improving and learning how to do this better, because if it's bad on day one but somehow better every other day, that's progress.
Well, you know, so by the time we get to Second Bull Run, it's August of 62, and the 48th now has 1 year of history under their belt. So they were organized a year earlier in Schuylkill County. All 10 companies came from that same county. They're engaged at Second Bull Run. Some people say Nagel. If you go outside of Schuylkill County, you'll hear Nagel. If you go in Schuylkill County, it's Noggle.
All right, well,
so forgive me for going back and forth.
I appreciate that because I generally say Nagel too.
Yeah.
Well, this is why this is okay, because our good friend Eric Mone, who's also from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, likes to just rip us when we say Gettysburg. He's like, it's Gettysburg. It was named after James Geddes. And, you know, he's right, because anytime I hear normal people say Gettysburg, it's Gettysburg. And then I go to Gettysburg, and I'm the weirdo. So I get it.
Well, Noggle, by this point, is a brigade commander.
He
led the unit into the fight at the unfinished railroad cut. Mm-hmm. So his brigade is now the 2nd Maryland, 6th New Hampshire, and the 48th Pennsylvania, and they pierced through Stonewall Jackson's line on August 29th.
Okay, a couple things I noticed there. First, there was no Maine or Michigan regiments in those, so suck it, boys. Maryland, let's go. And I also just want to shout it out again. Jackson, once again, having his lines broken. It's a theme on this show we like to highlight is, Matt and I do an exercise, maybe you'll appreciate this, it's called credit and criticism.
Yes.
Like, apply it both when it's due, because sometimes we unfairly lean into one or the other.
And we'll get to Antietam.
Yeah. And this started because McClellan obviously gets a lot of criticism when he also deserves a lot of credit, and Jackson in other places gets a lot of praise when he deserves a lot of criticism, and we use these guys but also I just like to needle the piss out of Stonewall Jackson fans because they forget that he wasn't the commanding general of the Army of Northern Virginia from time to time. So
on that August 29th, when they went into battle for the first time, they punched right through Jackson's line, marching past Groveton and in the unfinished railroad cut. 2nd Maryland, 6th New Hampshire begin to roll up the flanks on Jackson, and the 48th pierces their center. But there they were alone in the woodlot. They had no support, as was the case for all the Union attacks on that 29th of August.
Right.
And then moments later, they're getting fired on from their flank and rear. And the 48th is like, you know,
what's happening?
Yeah, so get up on the bank of the railroad and let them know that we're friends, right?
Yeah.
So a few of the officers took the banners of the 48th, and they began waving it on top of the embankment, and that just led to a hail of gunfire when they realized they're surrounded. So they got hammered.
Those weren't friendly Billy Yank behind them.
By this point, Jackson had orchestrated a counterattack that crushed the left flank of Noggle's brigade.
The counterattack.
Yeah. And the Confederate soldiers not only got around the 48th, but they subsequently captured their knapsacks.
Mm.
So going into battle, the 48th took out all their knapsacks. Noggle tied up his horse his chestnut-colored horse to a fence right before they got into the fight, and now all of it falls into Confederate hands.
Damn.
And they're surrounded on three sides. The only safe way out was to the right, and some fellas recognized that and made their way out of that trap. Others ran to the left and found themselves captured. So I mentioned about the numbers. I think they lost about 160 men in that.
Did take a hit.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah, so that they suffered heavily there, and a good number missing, and they're getting cut off. They got surrounded. So That was their first real baptism. That was their first
That's a hell of a baptism.
Fight. And I think we have to keep in mind, now, Second Boer Run, we oftentimes in Civil War history, we just like compartmentalize these battles. Okay, this battle happened, and then this battle happened, but following Second Boer Run, they're engaged again briefly at Chantilly.
Thank you for mentioning that, John, because Chantilly is such an important overlooked fight. Now, it's unfortunately, it's basically a destroyed battlefield. Mm-hmm. There's a mall on top of it.
Right.
But it's such an important fight
nice
for keeping 4 acres, for keeping back Jackson.
Right. Yeah, so they were engaged briefly. And 2 weeks later, they're at South Mountain, and then they're at Antietam. So, I mean, these battles are happening within a matter of weeks.
Yeah, right, we are big proponents. First of all, we officially call the battle the Dilly and Chantilly, as you would.
I don't recall recalling it.
I established it in season one. I'm sure it's somewhere. I'm sure it's somewhere back there. And if not, I'm officially doing it now. It's the Dilly and Chantilly. But since we are Maryland campaign guys, like when we get to do our bread and butter thing, like we usually start our story here, and even so, like we also context back even further because it is all one thing. Mm-hmm. Like as soon as we start talking about Second Manassas, I am already thinking about rivers about to get crossed. Mm-hmm. It is one story; it's all one flow, right?
Yes, it is. And I think we need to keep that in mind when we think when we're so apt to so quickly criticize McClellan. You know,
the
army that he inherited, you know, is. He's piecing it together on the go.
Mm-hmm. We have just leaned into it now. We're not like McClellan fans shouted from the rooftop, but we're not haters anymore. Yeah, I think that's we're like stuck in the middle.
And you know, another thing too to keep in mind about the 48th and the 9th Corps. By this point, of course, Burnside is being leaned on heavily by McClellan. Burnside is one of the more successful generals thus far in the war.
Right.
Fredericksburg has not yet happened, you know, so McClellan is leaning on his old friend. He commanded a wing in Maryland. Then things kind of fall apart, and McClellan really just, you know, changes his tune on Burnside's role at Antietam after Fredericksburg. But that's a story for another day.
Oh, we'll have you back John.
But the Ninth Corps, of course, they do force the gap at Fox's Gap. They do, in my estimation, have the most difficult assignment at Antietam of any Union Corps. Even before they had to carry out their operation, they had to literally fight their way across the creek. No other Union Corps had to deal with that. They all got across without any opposition.
Right. The only contested crossing.
Only contested crossing. And it was, you know, the worst terrain.
Yeah, the worst place to do that crossing. You've got the cliff face in front of you.
It's the worst terrain. So there again, they do partake in the capture of the bridge. They are providing covering fire for the first several attacks toward the bridge, and they ultimately do cross. Brought into the action later on, they suffer, again, about 60 casualties. So you look over the course of the last 2 weeks, you know, they're losing 160-plus at Second Boer Run. They lose a handful of soldiers at South Mountain, now 60 more, and now all of a sudden the unit is halved when we account for sickness and other casualties along the way. But at Antietam, of course, they cross the bridge. They're later called in to help shore up the line after A.P. Hill attacks. But the story of one lieutenant up there, and it's told very graphically in the regimental histories, and there was a lieutenant from Port Carbon, Pennsylvania, and the regimental historian remembered very distinctly looking off and seeing a Confederate cannon up on Cemetery Hill. He saw the smoke, and then moments later he heard the roar and the thud, and that ball apparently bounced off the ground. And Sergeant William Traynor was replacing his ramrod, Company E, in his musket when the cannonball hit his right arm, tore it right off. And the ramrod went right through Lieutenant Cullen's chest.
Jeez!
Right through.
Fatally?
Right through. And Lieutenant Cullen went up to his captain, and he opened up his shirt, and then he just dropped dead.
Holy schmoly.
And that was Lieutenant William Cullen. Poems were written about this guy because of the respect the men had for him. And not too far away, Lieutenant William Kistler was lying prone when a bullet or a shell fragment tore into his right shoulder. And it carried his epaulettes into his lungs. So the bullet, the clothing, the epaulette is all made his way into his right lung. And he was carried from the field, and no doctor looked at him. They thought, there's no way he's recovering from this wound. You know, it looks so fatal.
I feel like you're about to tell us he recovered from
Well, a few days later, I think it was literally two, three days later, September 19th or 20th, they discovered that his uniform is now dried solid with blood. You know, it's just, you know, and he was breathing. And he was still breathing. And they were able to get him back to the living.
Holy crap.
But he would join the Veterans Reserve Corps later on in the war, so he didn't return to field duty.
Does he cough his epaulets up at some point?
He does.
I was going to literally ask, is he just like, oh, and there's like some gold braid? He does,
and he would spend the rest of his life coughing up bits of uniform fragments and all from his lung, and but he never extracted the bullet. The bullet remained, apparently, in his lung for the rest of his life.
See, that might outdo. So when I'm on that part of the battlefield, I usually think about a guy from The Cutting Room of Matt. So Matt's written, a couple books, and I have a soft spot from one of the guys that didn't make it into one of Matt's books. It's this guy, Tracy Cheever, who is, I believe, with the 35th Massachusetts, and he is dinged by a rail fence, like a fence rail.
Right.
Artillery hits the fence, thing goes flying, and he's like full body concussed by it. But I think this is a little more gnarly. Like, dude got a rammer, and then, this is a little more dismal.
Now, that was according to the regimental historian, you know, but it wasn't unusual for there to be ramrods fired, you know.
I know.
That would pierce through.
Just like, holy crap. Yeah.
So, I mean, there also is where George Dentzer met his demise. I remember very well working the information desk one time, and a visitor came to the desk and said, do you know where the 48th Pennsylvania was? I'm like, well,
here's the man to ask.
Well, it turns out they were descendants of the Dentzer brothers from Cressona.
Wow.
And I visited their graves many, many times growing up, because I grew up just 5 miles away from the Cressona Cemetery, and there lies at rest George Dentzer and John Dentzer. George was killed at Antietam, and his brother John is later killed at Petersburg, and they're buried side by side. So not only did they tell me that, but they also had a photograph of both of them.
That's awesome.
And you know, when I, you know, I grew up in Schuylkill County. I visited Civil War battlefields since I was a kid. And yes, I'm interested in the strategy, the tactics, but I'm more interested in the people. And when I got home, when I was a kid, I was, you know, kind of strange, but I would visit the cemeteries with a notebook and just write down names, write down units. And the 48th Pennsylvania appeared time and time again on these notebook cemeteries all throughout Schuylkill County. So I felt like I got to know them.
Mm-hmm. That's cool.
And, that's very cool.
There's a young, in our small town of Oregonburg, is a young man who lies at rest. And I'll tell the story later when we get to Spotsylvania. But yeah, for as long as I can remember this unit, and it's the people in the unit, it's the people in the regiment. You read their names, you look at their muster sheet, you get to know them a little bit. Then you get to read some of their letters, and you get to know them a lot more. But to me, when you see their photograph, it's like a kind of moment.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
You know, it's just, I always enjoyed, you know, trying to find, quote-unquote, discover, quote-unquote, photographs of soldiers in the 48th. So if anyone's listening, and if you have a photograph of the 48th soldier, but I'll just let you know that throughout the course of the war, there were over 1,800 soldiers who served in this unit, and I've only ever seen images of about 150 of them.
That's incredible.
And half of those are owned by Joe Stahl.
I was going to say, Matt's co-author probably owns half of those.
Antietam was, you know, that was engaged there, and they're also heavily engaged at Fredericksburg. And I go directly to Fredericksburg because I think oftentimes we forget the Ninth Corps at Fredericksburg, and we forget their attacks on Maurice Heights, and sometimes we forget about the Ninth Corps.
Yes.
Overlooked entirely. Sometimes when you look at the 2nd, the 5th, the 6th Corps, it just seems that when the Ninth Corps was attached to the Army of the Potomac, they're kind of looked at differently.
Listen, John, I have seen Gods and Generals. I know that the only thing that happens at Fredericksburg is the attack on Maurice Heights, and it's only done by the Irish Brigade.
Only the Irish Brigade.
I actually know Caldwell's Brigade gets mentioned by name because they got to bail out the just butchered Irish Brigade.
Good
but it's
point.
Like, that's the only thing that happens there. There's no other part of those battles, John.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, secondly, the 2nd, the 5th Corps attacks on Maurice Heights.
Are you telling me Ted Turner lied to me?
I'm not saying that. You know, oftentimes the focus at Maurice Heights is the 2nd Corps, is the 5th Corps, and Humphreys' division. But Sturgis' division attacks as well. And Noggle is still a brigade commander at this point, and he led his soldiers. I think his brigade is now 5 units strong. against that you know, impregnable position there at the base of the heights. And you don't hear about it much. But at Fredericksburg, they lose another, you know, 50-some guys. But two of their soldiers is actually killed in a chimney collapse.
Ooh.
So they cross the Rappahannock on the 11th or the 12th, and they camp out on Caroline Street. Unfortunately, they partake in the looting of Fredericksburg. And that night, during the overnight hours of December 12th into the 13th, the chimney collapsed right where these guys were camped, and two of their soldiers from Company B are killed by the collapse of a chimney.
I really hate reading accounts of that type of stuff. It's like, with all the actual insanity and opportunities to die going around, when you die, like, senselessly in a war, it's like, that makes me mad. Mm. Like, it's like, that sucks. Like, if you're going to die in this, you should be catching hail on the field. Like, you shouldn't, like, a brick. Jesus, well, while you're sleeping? Like, Jesus.
Yeah. So that certainly, it startled the unit awake in the middle of the night when that happened. And they were helping to extract another, you know, a few of their members who were also buried under the bricks. But, you know, if you get the opportunity to look at Oliver Bosby Shell's regimental history of the 48th, it's very, he's very, I don't know how to say it, clear in his writing and describing things. Like I talked about how he remembered seeing the puff of smoke and hearing the thud and the roar of that one particular shell. Well, at Fredericksburg, he wrote about standing at the edge of town right before they went into the attack, and a Confederate shell passed right through a small brick structure, and a couple of the officers, you know, emerged from this smoke and burst bricks, and he said he then turned to look at Lieutenant Francis Cook. And he saw a mini ball go into Lieutenant Cook's shoulder, and he saw it come out his knapsack on the back. Hmm. And he said he just vividly remembers that moment in time, like the smoke when it hit, and
in slow mo.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. So when you read this regimental, it's different from most. So the 48th has two regimental histories. Their official regimental history that was commissioned by the veterans units was published in 1908 by Joe Gould. And this is your traditional regimental history, okay? It is, you know, just chock full of anecdotes that are kind of just cobbled together.
Right.
But before Gould wrote his, Oliver Bosby Shell wrote his his reminiscence. And that was out in 1896. It's a slim volume, but it's very detailed and
it's vivid.
Yes,
like,
very
vivid. It's alive. Right. Like that's what we, yeah. I appreciated that you were like, I want to focus on the people. Cause at what I do at work, that's kind of where I am is I'm great. The muskets, great. The French, the Indian, the tactics, like all great. But like, I'm the personnel of the place I work, the personnel and like the people are what make it real. And I'll tell you, connecting to it, right, you talk about, you know, you start reading the letters and they become a little bit more real, a little more alive. Then you see the picture. It's like you can really, like, take somebody off of a page if you put enough effort into it. So
right,
that unit history is probably the one to read if you're looking to understand. The other one, better probably for research.
Yes, but I would agree.
If you're looking to understand or get as close to it because you weren't there, I'd probably read, what's this guy, Bosley?
Bosby Shell.
Yeah. So Bosley is the hair treatment. And I probably should call Bosley when this show is over for my bald ass.
But, it's an interesting name. It's Oliver Christian Bosby Shell. He was born in Vicksburg, Mississippi.
Is he in the right place?
Yeah. His family then moved to Pottsville and became kind of prominent up there. But he later became the director of the U.S. Mint in Philadelphia.
Oh. Wow.
So I think he helped to produce some First Defender medals because he was a First Defender as well.
He's like, we should totally do this. He's like, by the way, unbiased, we should totally do this.
So he was a First Defender as well. He wrote about the three times he met Abraham Lincoln. You know, we think about history. I mean, these are the people making history.
Yeah,
definitely.
You know, which is why I like to, you know, tell these personal stories, even though you may have never heard of Francis Cook or Michael Kistler, you know, or William Cullen.
Yeah.
You know, when you go to their grave sites and you get to know their hometowns, you get to know their families by looking at their census records. You know, you know that William Cullen left behind four young daughters, you know, upon his death. So you get to know them as people, not just as statistics or blocks of blue moving on a map.
And that's what we should be endeavoring to do, because then we're actually attempting to understand. I don't presume that we'll ever actually understand. None of us were there.
Right.
And what I mean by that is not like you had to be there type of thing, but it's like the moment is unique. It's like it is like a snowflake. The moment is unique to those who experience it, and we didn't. But by doing our best to bring these people, these atmospheres to life, we connect to it. And I think that's awesome. I think that's beautiful, John.
Well, let me and I'll also say, before we turn the calendar, Schuylkill County produced a good number of units. And I'm sure Jake talked about it.
He did.
The 96th Pennsylvania, hard-fighting unit in the 6th Corps. I mean, these were the guys in the front rank of Upton's attack at the Mule Shoe. As Pennsylvania, 96 was a tough unit. They were almost exclusively Schuylkill County.
I'm not going to lie, John. Yeah. When I see Pennsylvania units in the war, I almost feel like they all come from Schuylkill County.
Okay.
It's like, like 7,000 regiments and companies from all from Schuylkill County.
There were a lot of soldiers, and Jake probably talked about the outpouring of volunteerism, that enthusiasm. But there's a letter written by John Porter from Company I of the 48th, and he was a captain. And in one of his letters home to his young wife, he said, "I cannot believe that there are still young men at home when life is much easier here in the Army." I mean, he literally said that it's much easier in the Army than in the coal mines.
Is that three hots and a cots?
I'll believe that, yeah.
He's underground breathing dust
right. online? Yeah. And because he was a tough, he worked there as well. And a lot of these guys, they may have been trying to escape that. I don't know. I don't know the motivations behind it. But there was this outpouring of patriotism. This was outpouring of volunteerism, and of course the war progressed and it got more and more difficult to rely upon that initial enthusiasm, that war fever, so to speak. So now the calendar has turned to 1863, and the end of the war is still very far off. Nobody knows that. Joshua Siegfried is now commanding the 48th, and Joshua Siegfried, he wrote a letter to the editor of the local newspaper when 1863 began, January 1st, and he talked about this war now being a fight for freedom. And he would later go on to lead a brigade of USCT troops in the 9th Corps at the crater of Josh Siegfried. We look into these motivations and all that, and most of 1863, the 48th Pennsylvania is in Lexington, Kentucky.
Wow.
They follow Burnside out west.
Okay.
And, Burnside, of course, we know the story. He's relieved of his duties end of January of 63, and his 9th Corps goes with him.
You might be shocking a lot of people right now by just talking about he does more than after Fredericksburg.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
He does a lot more.
People always think it's the end of the show for him.
No. Burnside, he does... and I think kind of the refreshing thing about Burnside is, he accepted responsibility. He said, "This was my mistake."
We don't hate on Burnside on this show because it's like we acknowledge he never wanted that command.
Right.
The only thing I think I was ever critical of was I asked, it's like if you have a thing that's working, right? Like, when McClellan is getting relieved, getting fired for just simple speak there, the plan he's put in place is working, right? Let's get a section of the ANV out in the open. Let's wrap him up and cut him off. And Longstreet has just stepped out in front of him. So the plan's working, right?
Yep.
McClellan, you're fired. Burnside, you're in, because if not, it's Hooker. I'm always just like, why doesn't Burnside just continue the plan that's already in motion and working? That one is kind of rendered also moot because he steals the march. It's after that. It's like after that. It's but like if you think about it, he's successful everywhere but the top, and we dog him for being at the top when he didn't want to be. It's like that guy rocked in the Carolinas.
Yes,
I mean he literally walked through the Great Dismal Swamp with his boys. Like that's a terrible place to drive through today. So just thinking about like the way we perceive him, it's like Fredericksburg and it's the end. His name appeared in our Vicksburg episode.
Right.
Because I was asking, how do we start hearing about these news, the news of these two great July 63 moments? And Burnside, I guess, is helping to spread word about what's happening. It's right. Oh, yeah, he's still out there. Like, he's still there.
He was. And he would take most of his 9th Corps. I mean, of course, he became Department of Ohio. But most of the 9th Corps will be out to assist Grant. But the 48th Pennsylvania is detailed as provost guards for Lexington, Kentucky.
Ah.
So they got to spend 6 months patrolling the streets of beautiful downtown Lexington.
It is a beautiful city.
And I tell you what, collecting photographs, I always look for those Lexington back marks because they really had nothing to do but get their picture taken.
Right.
So right. A lot of the images that I've seen of the 48th is from various galleries in Lexington, Kentucky.
That's a cool detail.
Yeah. So they were there. They did not go further south. I know a lot of the 9th Corps units suffered heavily with disease during the Vicksburg campaign.
Right.
But the 48th remained there from April to September of 63. And a lot of these young men are falling in love. A lot of them are meeting their wives. Henry Pleasance. Mm. You know, we know Henry Pleasance as the mastermind of the Petersburg Mine.
Right.
That was in the summer of 64. But in the summer of 63, he met a young lady from Lexington. He fell in love and got married.
Did he go back to Lexington after the war?
No. She
goes to
him.
Okay.
Now, Henry Pleasance, and again, we'll talk about him, but he is this kind of mercurial, temperamental, I don't know, you want to say like young genius of a kid. You know, he's born in Buenos Aires, Argentina.
He's eccentric.
I didn't know that.
He was, yeah. His father is a merchant from Philadelphia.
Huh.
His mother is the daughter of some Spanish nobleman.
Hmm.
And he's born in Buenos Aires. And his father died when he was only 11 or so. And so he is sent to live with an uncle in Germantown, Pennsylvania, north of Philadelphia. Arrives speaking Spanish. He doesn't speak English when he arrives in Philadelphia. So, but, you know, he goes to school. He learns engineering, and he goes to work for the Pennsylvania Railroads, and he will literally blast his way through mountains.
That's cool.
Here's a guy already before the war knows how to use powder to blast holes through mountains for rail lines. Well, he goes to Pottsville because that's mining, you know, central there. And he is a civil mining engineer. And he fell in love with the daughter of the editor of the newspaper. And he got married. And unfortunately, she died about a few months later after that.
Mm-hmm.
And he was heartbroken. This young man, his whole life ahead of him, lost his young bride just months after they were married. He had to bury her. And then the war began. And he then made the army his...
Yeah, no time
his
to
love.
Grieve.
Yes. Yeah.
And so he entered as captain of Company C of the 48th Pennsylvania. A lot of Irish... immigrants there are first-generation Irish-Americans in Company C from Heckscherville. And I'm sure Jake talked about the labor disturbances and in the Heckscherville Valley.
Yeah, that was
Valley.
Actually kind of the focus of that episode was when things really started to go haywire about, you know, on the labor front and kind of having these, like, lordship-type things.
Yeah.
Things were really kind of violent and bad for a long time.
In your research on the 48th and Pleasance and whatnot, being an immigrant himself and first generation, was he, while he's from a very different part of the world and his family was he able to kind of relate with his Irish troops and immigrant troops and things like that?
Apparently, Henry Pleasance had a fierce temper.
Oh,
and,
okay.
And he several times would run afoul of some of the soldiers in his unit.
Hmm.
And... we'll talk more, but he had such a temper that Oliver Bosby Shell in his regimental history, he wrote about it.
Oh, wow.
So if it made it into print, you know, I guess
it made an impression.
He could not write about it because I guess everybody reading it is like, yeah, but what about? So he fell in love in Lexington, and the regiment is there for 6 months until September 63, and then they rejoined Burnside's forces for the East Tennessee campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So Burnside, of course, defeats Longstreet pretty soundly for
East Tennessee.
Yeah,
he does. He helps secure East Tennessee for the Union,
mm-hmm.
and the 48th is every bit involved in that campaign at Fort Sanders. And
So
here's this unit now, 2 years in, 2 years of history, from Coal Country, Fort Monroe, Hatteras Island, New Bern, Second Bull Run, Maryland, Fredericksburg, Kentucky, Tennessee.
Dude, they're so seeing the country.
They are. Yep. I mean, this is the Ninth Corps.
I think there's a strong argument to be made that the Ninth Corps does more movement across the country than any other command in the war.
And one of the soldiers of the Ninth Corps, I think Joe Gould in his regimental, said, we tallied it up, and we traveled over 12,000 miles by foot, by rail, by water.
Jeez.
Wow.
During the war.
Man.
And the dead of the 48th are buried in seven different states.
Seven states.
Seven
they
states.
Are spread out.
Yeah.
I got to scratch an itch. I'm not going to lie. Ever since we have said the words Buenos Aires on this show, I have been dying to to make a Starship Troopers reference.
Of course.
Because as soon as you said he was born there, I was like, oh, I wonder if any of his ancestors died in the asteroid attack that started the Great Bug War. Have you seen that terrible
I did not.
Movie?
No, I have not.
So in the 90s, they made the cult sci-fi film, which is basically
based
a warning
off
about
the novel.
Fascism, about Starship Troopers, these guys in the future, and they end up fighting this alien bug race. But for some reason, everybody lives in like Buenos Aires. And it's like the most random part of it, but it gets annihilated. And so as soon as you say Buenos Aires, my brain is like, I wonder if he had ancestors in that futuristic asteroid attack from the bugs.
Well, I don't know about that. No, not entirely
familiar. That's why we brought you here to discuss this epic
Thank
film.
You for taking that in stride, but, John.
I had to itch it. I had to itch it.
The winter of 63 was what they called their Valley Forge winter. It was miserable because they are just encamped in the winter in East Tennessee in the mountains.
It's cute, though, from a bunch of guys near Valley Forge.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Of course it's your Valley Forge. You're from there. You know it.
Well, they're snowed in. And this was a critical moment for the administration because it's re-election time. And, you know, I know we oftentimes talk about battles being turning points, but the election of 64 is one of the most important turning points of the war.
Agreed.
Yeah. So 63 is about to become 64. The war still continues. And Lincoln is not anticipating re-election. No president had been re-elected to a second term since Andrew Jackson.
Right.
We need to end this war, and we need to keep our good soldiers in. So they began to offer
bounties
and bonuses for re-enlisted veterans. So just about the turn of the new year, when 63 became 64... In August and September of 64 is when the three-year term of service for the 48th is expiring. But in the winter time is when they approached them and said, hey, anybody wants to re-enlist, here's what we got. We've got a bounty. We'll give you a title of veteran. You get to wear that stripe.
Yep.
And you could go home for 30 days. So by this point, I believe there were about 275 guys in the regiment. Began with 1,000 when they marched off to war. Now they're down to about 275. And I believe all but about 40 to 50 guys re-enlist.
Wow.
So because of that, those 250 or so guys who re-enlisted, they go home in February, March of 1864. And this, to me, is, I hate to say it like this, kind of like their last happy moment. Because they get home, and they're greeted in Pottsville and all around Schuylkill County as heroes. They have no idea what's going to happen when they return to the Army.
Right.
And what happens is the Overland Campaign.
Yeah. Right.
And the war in 64 is much different, it seems, than the war in 63 and 62 and 61.
It's a grind.
The romance and majesty of the Civil War takes place in 62 and 63. I feel like the violence, the ugly fighting, that's 64.
Every battle was horrific. Yeah. Right. But there's something about Spotsylvania. There's something about Cold Harbor.
Yeah.
And so the 48th Pennsylvania goes home to recruit. And they are able to get these young kids who were too young to enlist in 61, who were 15 years old, who are now 18, who are 19. And they join up.
Overland.
They are signing up. So the 48th Pennsylvania, they are able to retain their numeric designation. You got 75% of your guys to re-enlist. You get to keep your regimental number.
Veteranized.
So the 48th Pennsylvania does, and they're quite proud of that. And then they go off to war again. And they don't know where they're going because the other guys who did not re-enlist are still in East Tennessee. But they are told to go to Annapolis.
Yep.
Go to Annapolis, Maryland. We're going to rendezvous there with the rest of the Ninth Corps. And also rendezvousing at Annapolis is the division of USCT soldiers who are joining Burnside's Ninth Corps as well. So Burnside is called back east. He will be attached to the Army of Potomac.
Mm-hmm.
And the 9th Army Corps is back in Virginia. The 48th Pennsylvania is back in Virginia. They're at Annapolis. Sadly, there was a young man, Michael Wilson, who died of nostalgia, they called it, or homesickness. Mm. I mean, there was something going on there.
I feel like I'm dying in nostalgia right now.
Am I that boring?
No. But just like, you know, as I get older, I'm like thinking about the 90s a lot, you know? Like the music.
A long time ago.
The music, you know. The Yankees were good then. Like, we'll get to the Yankees at some point.
Well, but when I was, you know, it is getting to a point in life where people talk about the 90s, and I'm like, oh, that was what, like 5-10 years ago? Like,
yeah.
It was like 30 years ago.
We're both Yankees fans.
We are.
So when I think about New York Yankees, when I think about the 90s, I'm like, the Yankees, like, they're a good baseball team, but they suck. They keep failing. They keep disappointing. And it's like, you know, remember that time when they went to like 5 World Series in 4 years, 6 years, won 4 of like 5 of them? It was just like, what a great experience that was.
They need Paul O'Neill.
Yeah, no, I agree.
They need a Paul O'Neill back.
Paul needs to come back. But,
I'll let you two discuss
that. When you said nostalgia, it's like, I've been exclusively thinking about how the 90s were awesome for me, not for a lot of people, but like, it's like, that's been on my mind lately. The nostalgia, I feel it. No, well, you're not boring, sir. You're amazing.
Okay, so the 48th is there at Annapolis, Maryland, and they're about to embark upon this slaughter of a campaign, the Overland campaign, and of course we know what they did at Petersburg and digging that tunnel, but right. The 6 weeks leading up to that, the 7 weeks, 8 weeks, whatever it was, this regiment is getting one day after the next. It did not become a matter of if, but when. Your time was up in this unit. They fight at the Wilderness. And, of course, being in the Ninth Corps, they're kind of forgotten amongst the 2nd and 6th Corps at the Wilderness. But they're there. They lose a good number of men. But at Spotsylvania, they attack East Salient. Oh. So when people think Spotsylvania May 12th, they think 2nd Corps. And oftentimes forgotten is the Ninth Corps' attack. On the eastern leg there, but at Spotsylvania, they lose well over 150 men. So it is another devastating battle for that unit. And I mentioned in my hometown of Orangeburg, St. John's Cemetery, I always was struck by the grave of Henry Egge, E-G-E, and Company I, 18 years old. He was one of those who did not enlist in 61. He
did
was
you
too
have
young.
No idea what's coming for
yeah,
him?
Yeah, and he met his end at Spotsylvania, and in an attic in Orangeburg is still the grave marker the soldiers of the 48th placed for him on the battlefield of Spotsylvania, because his dad went down to get his body in 1865 and took home the board that had his name
That's
on
awesome.
It.
That's awesome.
Dude, so, imagine what the veterans' experience in those battles was like. You think about how quaint some of the 61 and 2 and 3 things you did were compared to those fights, and then think about the ones who weren't there for that. It's like, hey, welcome to the game. It's the worst moment of it all.
Yeah, in Spotsylvania, I mean, for the 48th, Henry Egge is killed there. An 18-year-old Charles St. Clair is killed there. And the Fredericksburg National Cemetery, there's almost an entire row of 48th Pennsylvania soldiers who all died at Spotsylvania, of course, side by side, buried there. But Henry Clay Jackson, a school teacher from Millersville University when the war begins, and he enlists. He makes it through, you know, Fredericksburg, Antietam. This guy's wounded like 2-3 times. He's captured at Bull Run. but his time ran out at Spotsylvania. He's lying prone, and he gets shot right through the neck. And he turned to James Allman, who was next to him, a sergeant in his company, and he says, I'm hit. And Sergeant Allman looked at him and said, where? He said, I don't know. Then his head just fell onto Almond's shoulder, and that's where he died. But Henry Clay Jackson was buried in a grave that, sadly, the marker was lost.
Oh.
So he rests in an unknown grave at Fredericksburg National Cemetery. And James Allman, that young man who was next to him, that sergeant, he remained in the Army throughout the war, and after the war, he became a brigadier general. And he's fighting alongside Theodore Roosevelt at San Juan Hill, and he's buried at Arlington today.
Wow.
So, yeah, if you're ever walking your path up toward the Arlington House, off to your right, you'll see the grave of Allman. That was 48th PA. Became
that's a cool
Brigadier
that's
very General cool. after the war. So, go ahead, Matt. I'm sorry.
No. John, could you speak a little bit to the unique position that the Ninth Corps is in when it rejoins the Army of the Potomac? Because it's not in the Army of the Potomac, per se. Right. It's an independent command under the umbrella of the Army of the Potomac.
And it seemed like they were kind of just an auxiliary unit whenever they were with the Army of the Potomac, you know, because Joe Hooker really didn't have any time for him. You know, he didn't much care at all. So when Burnside took the Ninth Corps with him, Hooker was fine with that. So now, I guess the uncomfortable thing is that Burnside's command, Burnside's commission, outranked Meade.
Right.
And Meade is still in command of the Army of Potomac. And Grant, who came east, who's traveling with the Army of Potomac, is thinking, well, all right, well, why don't we just have Burnside be an independent command? And let's see how this works
out. We'll just settle and this way.
It doesn't work out.
Yeah.
Burnside is to report to Grant. That became really cumbersome.
Right.
And Meade. Okay.
Are you trying to be diplomatic right now?
I know Meade, he was the victor of Gettysburg, but Meade in 64 has his boss looking over his shoulder the whole time.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
And it's an awkward position to be in. And now here comes Burnside, who outranks you.
Oh, yeah.
And in Meade's mind, Burnside failed to support his division at Fredericksburg. And
right.
Meade's division punched right through.
But whose line did he punch through?
Stonewall Jackson.
Let's go back to that. Yeah, let's get to that.
So he did break through Jackson's line, and Meade blamed Burnside, you know, for that defeat. You know, I may put the blame more on William Franklin, but that's another story for another day. So Meade also, it seems, doesn't have time for the Ninth Corps. And again, it seems that they are just kind of
there.
Attached, yeah. But not a part right. of the Army of the Potomac. By the way, Joe Hooker devised the Corps system, the Corps badge
right.
Thing for the Army, not for the Ninth Corps. So Burnside did his own.
Okay.
And I got to say,
that how that
perhaps
happened?
I'm a bit biased here, but I think the Ninth Corps Corps badge is the coolest.
What
badge.
Is the Corps agree. Badge?
The Corps badge is an anchor.
Oh, mm-hmm. It is the anchor.
And it's a cannon barrel crossed, yep. And there's a rope connecting them in the shape of a nine.
Oh, yep. It is 1,000,000% so, the coolest. Yeah. I didn't realize that was their Corps badge.
That's because
everybody
badge.
Else's Corps badges are like a
circle, a star,
a triangle.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, oh,
but here we have this, you know, cross anchor and cannon barrel in the yeah. keystone shape with mm-hmm. a rope connecting them in the shape of a number nine.
No, that one's badass,
so,
John.
Yeah,
like,
so.
I will give Pennsylvania credit for that. That is so, the best Corps badge anywhere.
So, you know, Meade doesn't have much time for the Ninth Corps, I think, and things really came to a head at Petersburg. And unfortunately, a lot of Ninth Corps soldiers paid the price, I think, for that. So Spotsylvania happens. The Ninth Corps continues to remain on the move. They're engaged again at Cold Harbor. And on one day leading up to the Battle of Cold Harbor, Confederate sharpshooters kill three of their best officers. One single day, Major Joseph Gilmore is mortally wounded. Samuel Lobenstein from Schuylkill-Haven is killed. William Hume is killed, all by sharpshooters' bullets on the road toward Cold Harbor, just
wow.
one day. And then they participate in the fight at Cold Harbor. There again, they lose, you know, 60-plus, 70 men attacking the far left of the Confederate line. They were on the very end of the Union line to the north there at Cold Harbor. And then Petersburg happens. So I talked about the Second Bull Run being their costliest battle. The veterans of the 48th Pennsylvania believe that the June 17th attack at Petersburg was their shining moment.
Hmm.
The June 17th attack that they attacked Battery 15 east of Petersburg. They captured two Confederate flags. They captured a few cannons. Two Medal of Honors come out of that attack. And, of course, we know the Ninth Corps outperforms the Army of Potomac during those attacks at Petersburg, June 17
right.
and 18.
Yep. This is the second battle of Petersburg.
Right, even right. George Meade congratulates them for their success in a circular that went out. So the 9th Army Corps has captured a good bit of the Confederate line east of Petersburg. They drive them back toward a closer line toward the city, and that leads up to the mine. So June 17th, they lose again. They lost a number of soldiers June 17th. And in my head, I'm going to cemetery by cemetery in Schuylkill County because I know where all these fellas are laid to rest.
Mm-hmm.
So Joseph Edwards is killed in action. Curtis Pollock, and a few years ago, I edited his letters from Pottsville. He's mortally injured that day, June 17th. And like I mentioned before, it just seemed a matter of not when, or not if, but when.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, it just seemed like all these young officers early in the war, these first defenders
mm-hmm.
who were in Washington in April, now are lieutenants and captains, and it just seems like...
I mean, you hang around long enough
in
that type of environment.
Well, they got close. They got close to the Confederate lines, and of course, the story, you ask 10 different people, what happened, you get 10 different answers. But from what I understand, the 48th Pennsylvania was occupying an advanced position looking toward the Confederate lines, which was only a few hundred feet away east of Petersburg, and Henry Pleasance is now in command of the unit. Joshua Siegfried is brigade command, and Henry Pleasance, the civil mining engineer with this temper, you know, who had met the love of his life the year before in Lexington and married her, he overheard, apparently, one of his soldiers say, well, we could blow that fort out of existence if we could just run a mine under it. And others would say, others would say it was divisional commander Robert Potter who had the idea. Mm-hmm. But I would say many people probably had that same idea.
You got a whole regiment of coal miners. Right.
So by this point, they're about 400 strong. And so, again, they had reenlisted in that winter. They had suffered tremendously on the road to Petersburg. And now Henry Pleasance has this idea. Why can't we tunnel under the mine? Why can't we, you know, tunnel under the Confederate lines? I used to blast holes in mountains, you know?
Yeah, right. This is right in my wheelhouse. Yeah.
So Pleasance, he took the idea to Burnside. And it was a sweltering hot June 24th of 1864 in Burnside's tent. The sweat is just dripping off these two officers. And Burnside, of course, has that ever-present cigar. It had to be kind of, you know, his headache-inducing environment in his tent. And Pleasance is explaining his plan. And Burnside is listening. Mm-hmm. You know, Burnside was eager to try new things. So he thought, why not? So he said to Pleasance, do it, and I'll take this to Meade. So Pleasance returned to the regiment, and he looked at George Gowan, one of his lieutenants, and he said, get me a list of all the miners in this regiment. And George Gowan...
So that was everybody in the regiment?
Not quite. Yeah, so.
The whole regiment just assembled.
Like we're talking school county.
Well, believe it or not, there were a total of 99
that's
coal miners.
A lot of coal miners.
Out of this
almost
unit,
25% of your force at that point.
Those 99 are identified as having experience in coal mines, and that's skilled labor, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, you get under the earth that deep, that far, in really confined spaces, I can never do it. I come from families of coal miners. Mm. My grandfathers, my great grandfathers were coal miners.
Deep under mines, deep underwater.
Yeah,
no
I don't
thanks.
Do that. No. I don't do that.
No. So surface dweller.
Henry Pleasance goes back to his unit and he talked to George Gowan and they got a list of miners and they went to work. So just to quickly follow up with George Gowan. Like Henry Pleasance, he was not originally from Schuylkill County. He was from Germantown also. His brother later becomes the lead prosecutor for the Molly Maguires.
Really?
Benjamin Franklin Gowan. So George Washington Gowan is now working with Henry Pleasance in this mine operation.
Is Thomas Jefferson Gowan a part
of
this conversation?
Yeah, it seems like it should be. Yeah.
So, he probably doesn't exist. That's not a real person. I accidentally his name, right? Okay, dear God.
So the terrain, they looked for the best place to start running this mine.
Right.
And there was a descent in the landscape where the ground descended into a creek, mm-hmm. and where the ground began to taper down, they thought, okay, this is the area we're going to begin to dig our mine. So Henry Pleasance then looked at this 25-year-old Welsh sergeant by the name of Henry Reese, nicknamed Snapper, and he put him in charge of the operation. He said, you are going to be in charge of everybody who goes in and out of this tunnel. So Henry Reese set up his camp right outside the entrance to the mine, and it's just reading about the engineering and the work that was done on this mine is fascinating to me because I have no background in engineering, you know, any of this.
Yeah.
But, you know, they began to dig into the earth. And over the first 2 days, June 25th and June 26th, they got about 40 feet in. So they have a mine. It's about 3.5 feet tall. It's tapered on the bottom, so you can never stand upright in this thing.
Right.
So they're going in foot after foot. And the first, you know, 40 or so feet, the digging was good. It was nice, soft soil. Then they began
to hit
the
thicker
clay. They began to hit that
the rocky stuff.
Yeah, thick stuff. apparently one of the soldiers pulled out what they thought was a mastodon bone. That was like the big highlight as they were excavating this dirt. You know, one of the soldiers found what he thought was.
The archaeologists in our listener group were like, did you catalog it? Did you catalog it?
So meantime, the 48th has begun this project, and they're all for it. They could do it, you know.
Yeah.
This is no problem. I mean, the Confederate line is like 500 feet away. We got this.
Yeah, we'll get there.
So Burnside goes to Meade. And Meade is not buying it.
Right.
You know, Meade is like, you know, we've never had a successful tunnel dug in the history of warfare. The longest one is like 100 feet. Mm. But I tell you what, Burnside, I'll go to Grant with it. So keep your guys busy. Keep them working on this thing. I'll take it to Grant. And Meade then turns to his engineer, James Duane, chief engineer, Army Potomac. And Duane is, this is a military engineer. He has no time for a civil engineer in Henry Pleasance. So these two guys are just instantly.
This will not work. Mm.
Yeah, and let me tell you about James Duane.
He's not British.
So who was the engineer on McClellan's staff who tried to identify the forward crossing points at Antietam, but James Duane? Who was on the engineering staff who did not get the pontoons to Fredericksburg?
So what the hell does this jabroni know?
So James Duane is the thorn in Burnside's side throughout the entire war. And now James Duane, the chief engineer of the Army, is just saying to me that this will never work. And James Duane literally wrote the book on mining operations in the military. And on page, I don't know, whatever page, but he identified the, I don't know, 70 tools that are needed for a successful mining operation. And guess how many he supplied to the 48th?
None of them.
Not a single one.
Dude, when this is over, spoiler, because this explosion happens, Pleasance goes to this guy, and it's like, by the way, you need to write a new chapter for your book. In fact, I wrote it for you.
I mean, not a single spade, not a single shovel, not a single a single box, you know, to remove any of the dirt. So Pleasance is improvising. He has to. So he gets, you know, picks, he gets shovels, he cuts off the handles so that they're only about 2 feet because, again, the tunnel's only 3 foot tall.
Right.
They're going to blacksmiths, and they're getting their size of the picks reduced so they could wield them down underground. And they're emptying cracker boxes, ammunition boxes, and they're attaching them to hickory poles so they could sled the dirt
out.
Oh, my God.
You know, what an operation.
It is. It's quite the operation. And at first, it was only the 99 miners who were engaged in this. But then the entire regiment played a part. And what the other guys began to do was take the dirt far back.
Sure.
Because all the trees have been cut down. So the trenches are dug. There are climbing towers behind the Confederate lines. They're watching. You know, all of a sudden, things got suspiciously quiet.
The Confederates are wondering, why are the dirt mounds getting taller?
Yeah, so that was the thing.
Why are their breastworks getting taller?
So these guys are taking out, you know, tons and tons of earth, one cracker box at a time, and they're going a mile plus to the rear to dump it. You know, we're talking Shawshank here,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So they're cutting down brush. They're cutting brush over this pile of dirt, and they're filling up sandbags with all this dirt that they're bringing out to fortify the trenches there. But no, it was quite an operation. And Duane thought that the miners will suffocate. They go in 100 feet, they're going to suffocate. There's no clean air underground. So Pleasance, he improvised again, and he had his guys not only dig the tunnel, but they're also building a wooden duct that is following them every foot of the way off to their right. And then he sank a chimney right behind the Union lines. So he bored down into the tunnel.
This is awesome.
And he had a fire going constantly in the tunnel where the hole was to bring in some fresh air. Yeah, so it's drawing in some fresh air, and that wooden duct is going to be...
Dude, this is so smart.
...funneling out the bad air so the guys aren't suffocating. But now you have smoke coming out of the ground behind the Union lines. So
good point.
Pleasance is also having his other guys build campfires at various places up and down. And by the way, if you showed your head above the trench...
You're dead.
You're getting hit, okay? So this was very... It was tough work. It was hard work. It was summer. It was hot. Again, all the trees are down.
John, I want to piggyback off this because I've got a theory that I've been working on in regards to this particular point in the Siege of Petersburg. There's a good chunk, not a huge chunk, but a good chunk of the Army of the Potomac that is no longer with the Army of the Potomac, okay? The 6th Corps has been pulled out for operations further north and a certain raid that's happening into Maryland. And the 19th Corps, which has been recalled from Louisiana, was supposed to join the Army of the Potomac and basically got waved north because of everything that's going on. It causes, or it appears to cause, offensive operations around Petersburg to essentially come to a halt or at least slow down significantly. And I really think that because of that, they had to start getting innovative. And we have guys like Pleasance or his division commander looking at options. Like, we don't want to just sit here in these holes. Yeah. We want to do something.
Right.
But we need to be innovative about it. And I really think, honestly, because of this lack of offensive capability, if you will, that they're looking at other options.
Oh, that could be. Yeah, it could be. And, of course, we need to end this war by the election.
Oh, good point. You know, now we got to move.
Yeah, because, again, Lincoln is not expecting to be reelected.
Right.
And I would assume not many people were, because now the armies have bogged down, you know, outside of Petersburg. And Sherman is having a tough road of it getting toward Atlanta.
Yep.
So, you know, Pleasance, he worked out a system where his guys are getting fresh air under the tunnel, and they're lighting fires elsewhere. But it is critically important that they get the measurement right. If the mine is too short, they just blast a hole in between the two lines. Right. If the line goes too long, they blast a hole behind the Confederate lines.
And do nothing.
It has to be directly under the Confederate line, Elliott Salient. And there's a brigade of South Carolinians in there, and Pegram's battery, not John, I think Richard Pegram. So Henry Pleasance needs a surveyor's tool. It's a theodolite. I hope I'm saying that right. And Duane has one, but it was being used elsewhere. So Burnside had to write to a friend in Washington, D.C. to send him a surveyor's tool. And it arrived eventually. So Henry Pleasance will then put on a burlap sack over his head. And he covers his hair with brush, with twigs and all. And he has his guys up and down the trench line raise up their kepis ever so slightly on their ramrods. And as they draw the Confederate sniper fire, this guy, Pleasance, in this burlap bag is popping up over the trenches
in surveys
to get this measurement exactly right. And it's, you know, every few days he's having to do this over and over and over again.
Dude, that's kind of neat, though, because we do the World War One trench stuff, and they do tactic stuff like that all the time. Dude.
Absolutely.
Like, we'll momentarily expose, put a helmet up on a rifle real quick, and then suddenly somebody's like, oh, okay, and then they duck real quick. Like,
now, the Confederates are wise to something going on.
Right.
They know something's up. You know, things are awful quiet. And they began to countermine. So they began to actually dig into the earth also, looking to find where this mine
might
be. I've always
been impressed that they realized that it might be a mine.
Yes.
I knew they were countermining, but the jump to that conclusion.
You got to that so fast. I was literally about to be like, how did they just go right to mining?
Well, E.P. Alexander, of course, he's oftentimes referenced. He's oftentimes quoted, and, you know, for good reason. But, you know,
he gave us the chicken quote.
Yeah, in his memoirs, he talks about, you know, he was wounded one day outside of Petersburg, and he should have told, you know, his bosses that he knew it would be on the 9th Corps front because the 48th Pennsylvania was in there, and they had the coal miner. I'm like,
how would you know?
So they are looking everywhere, you know, Confederates. And what actually happened one time, you know, this is kind of, you know, but the 48th Pennsylvania, they were down deep into the earth, okay? So they had to dig in straight, then they had to elevate their mine ever so slightly to get over some thick putty-like soil. They continued to go forward. And by the way, that putty-like soil is beginning to
sink
the mine.
Yeah.
So the other guys of the 48th are behind the lines, hammering together supporting frames for the mine. So they build it out here, they disassemble it, they bring it back in pole by pole, board by board, and they reassemble underground. They don't want to be hammering underground,
right,
where you're going to give away your position. So they are supporting this mine as it got deeper and deeper and deeper, and they're having bottles with candles to light their way. But at one point, a Confederate countermine literally crossed perpendicular over top their mine. So there's the 48th going, you know, westerly toward the Confederate line. there's a Confederate countermine running southerly right over top, and only a few feet of earth
separated
the two of them. So
I did not realize
that
got that close.
There's a lot of Confederate mines that are going, they're sinking down, they're going, and they're looking. They're just looking.
Do you know what I'm hearing out of this?
They're just not digging deep enough.
Do you know what I'm hearing out of this?
Hill 60?
Experienced miners knew you got to go deep. And counter miners who aren't probably experienced miners just start digging down.
Well,
they perceive to be far enough.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Right.
This is where I'd go. All right. But the real miners are like idiots. You got to go like 40 feet below that.
Well, the 48th then began to get wise. The Confederates know what's going on. They know there's mine because Confederate deserters said that. They said, we're looking for whoever this is. Yeah. So when they
digging? Because we think you're digging.
So the 48th main tunnel is completed, I think, by June 17th. July 17th. So they began on June 25th. By July 17th, they're done. 500 feet underneath Elliott Salient. But Henry Pleasants and two other officers spent most of that day lying on their backs listening. And every time they heard the Confederate guns fire from Elliott Salient, the earth would fall on top of them. It's kind of like you just hear this boom, and the dirt would come down. And what they were trying to do was just see if they could hear any of the countermining. Like, do they know where we are? So they got to a point directly underneath the Confederate lines, and now it was time to build the lateral galleries,
yeah.
So we're going to go to the left another 40 feet. We're going to go to the right another 40 feet. We're going to carve magazines into the side of this wall, and we're going to pack it with powder. So I'm so excited. He wants 12,000 pounds of powder.
Jeez.
12,000 pounds.
Doesn't get it, though,
does he? Doesn't get it. No, okay. He gets 8,000 pounds.
I mean, still jeez.
Yeah. Yeah, he gets 8,000 pounds, and it arrives in barrels. So these guys in the 48th had to carry in, you know, on their shoulders, one barrel of powder at a time in this 3-foot-tall tapered tunnel. By the way, with like candles lighting the way, and here they go. Past
exactly.
That might, okay, so I was about to ask a question, but that might have actually answered my question. I was like, "It's a barrel. Roll it."
But you don't want to be sprinkling the floor with it,
right? And command and control of oops, and it slips. Like, okay. All right, that makes a lot more sense.
So they go ahead and they fill up these wooden magazines that they had constructed and placed in these lateral galleries with the 8,000 pounds of powder. And timing is important. We need to get, because it gets damp, the powder is going to get damp. I need fuse. And if I could just have a single line, if I could have just a few pieces to splice together, I need, 400 and some feet of fuse. I know you have it. But of course, Dwayne doesn't provide it.
He's like, I don't want this to work.
Right. So
he wrote a book already.
He will send in fragments of fusing wire, 8 to 12 feet in length that he had to fuse together, all the way down the length of this tunnel. They're also digging a trough in the middle of the line for powder. They will sprinkle that, to assist the fuse on the way. But here's a critical moment. They have all the powder in there. It took less than a month. It took about 3 weeks. They have dug this mine, successfully kept it away from Confederate intelligence, and they have it packed now with powder. And what to do next? Well, wait a minute. You mean they're done? Meade and Grant are like, oh, you guys were still doing that? Because we kind of
forgot about it.
So, maybe we could send Hancock toward Richmond, and we could have him attack Richmond, then blast this mine to kind of confuse Lee. What is our intention? Where are we going with this, So Hancock begins to move toward Richmond, and Lee begins to send soldiers up there to confront Hancock up there. So the Confederate line is now thinner and thinner and thinner. So the moment to strike. Hancock's expedition goes nowhere. It fails. So Lee's guys begin slowly to return, okay? So now the mine is getting packed full, and we have to make sure that the blast goes up and that the blast does not come down the tunnel and out where you completely diffuse the whole thing.
Right.
So they began to pack powder or sandbags at the end of the tunnel. So the tunnel's dug, the galleries are dug, the powder's placed. Now they begin to just fill the tunnel with sandbags filled with dirt, to make sure that the blast goes up.
Yeah, leaving just enough room for the fuse.
Just
right?
The fuse on the bottom.
Yeah.
To come out. And again, fuse is getting, it's going to get damp, it's going to get wet. We need to do something. Okay, well, what's your plan, Burnside? I'm glad you asked, because I have a perfect plan. So here's the thing. We're gonna blow this mine, and we're going to send in my 4th Division, okay? We are going to skirt the crater, and we're going to have the other supporting units just pass on to Cemetery Hill, Blandford Cemetery behind, gain the high ground, we'll be behind the Confederate lines, we'll control their position, Petersburg will fall. Great. What division's leading this attack? My 4th Division, Ferraro's USCT soldiers.
Yeah, Ferraro.
Well, no, they can't lead the attack.
Right.
What do you mean they can't lead the attack? They had been preparing for this moment, you know, to lead the attack.
Right.
Well, Meade goes to Grant. And Burnside's thing was, these guys have not been engaged in battle since they joined the Army. The USCT units were parceled out to guard wagons.
Right.
What is not what they signed up to do. So they want to get involved in a fight. And this was their opportunity, or so thought Burnside.
And they're ready for it.
And not only that, they have not yet attacked entrenched Confederate lines.
Hmm.
Meade is having the most difficult time getting his other, you know, units to attack. So I'm not attacking that. They're trenches, you know? So they would be willing to go forward to attack. And by the way, it's an election year. What better way to reward Lincoln, you know, then have USCT soldiers lead this charge in to capture Petersburg, you know?
Right.
Well, you can't have those go in, because if it fails, it's an election year. Right. And it would look like we're, you know, just
sending these guys to the slaughter.
Right. So literally, it was the 11th hour. At 11 p.m. on July 29th, the mine was scheduled to be detonated early morning July 30th. Burnside is told by Meade that he cannot use Ferraro's division to lead the attack the following day. So he is just completely at a loss. He had no support for this project the entire time. The engineers did not support Pleasants at all, and the 48th miners, who are now just crouched, you know, hunched over, caked with dirt and mud from their month under the ground.
Flammable in their own right.
and now Pleasants, Burnside is in his tent with his 3 other brigade or divisional commanders. He's with Robert Potter, he's with Orlando Wilcox, and he's with James Ledley. And Ledley had just assumed divisional command a few days before. He was drunk on the June 17th attacks, and Grant would later write that he was the single worst divisional commander in the Civil War. So here is Wilcox. Here is Potter, steady, reliable, solid.
Mm-hmm.
Here is Ledley. I know, unproven, untested, untrustworthy.
Right.
Burnside should have delegated who's going to lead this attack. But at that moment, he asked. No one volunteered.
Understandable.
Yeah.
So he had them draw straws.
Right.
And the short straw went to Ledley. And Burnside spent time with Ledley, and this is after midnight now, and the USCT soldiers don't even know that they're about to be replaced. They're preparing for this attack near the front lines. Burnside tried to explain the plan to Ledley over and over and over again, but we're not even sure if Ledley ever conveyed that to his brigade commanders.
Really?
He just got his guys up to where they were supposed to go, and then he would find his way to a bomb-proof, and he would drink away the attack on July 30th.
What's about to happen would explain that they didn't get the information on the brigade level,
exactly.
Because anybody who passively hears skirt will go, well, yeah.
Right. And not only that, but also push up and down, north and south.
Yeah,
right.
Like, you know, to start moving lateral. Yeah. Right. Yeah, so yeah. But like, the fact that they go in and down first shows that they had no clue.
And, you know, unfortunately, that's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
And the crater was supposed to be detonated by, I don't know, 3:30, 4 a.m. Oh, hot, hot Saturday, July 30th. Temperature is over 90 degrees that day.
That's sweet. It's detonated at 3 or 4 in the morning?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, first of all, it's hot, being that hot in the middle of the night is terrible. And this happens in the dark?
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, darkness right before the dawn. And it would add to the confusion
drama
and all that.
Yeah.
So, Pleasants is there at the mine tunnel, and here he is at the fruition of this project that no one had faith in but he and his guys in Burnside.
Right.
They did it. They successfully tunneled 500 feet directly under the Confederate lines. The 2 lateral galleries are finished. It's packed with powder, sandbag. The fuse is out. They light the fuse, and then they get up. They watch. Any moment now, you know. They're calculating how long it's going to take for that fuse to get down to hit the powder.
And the moment is just painful.
But nothing happens. Nothing happens. And Burnside is about a mile to the rear. Everything is riding on this, too. You know, it's kind of redeeming his reputation with the Eastern Army here. You know, this would be his moment. His Ninth Corps is going to shatter the Confederate lines. Nothing happened. And Meade is sending messenger after, what's going on, Burnside? I told you it wouldn't work. You know, maybe you ought to cancel the whole thing. And Burnside's like, I don't know what's going on. You know, just so Henry Pleasance is beyond, you know, he's like, what is happening? And he said, I'm going to go and find out. I'm going to go into the tunnel and see what happened.
The fact that he chooses to do that has always been so amazing to me.
But he stopped. Henry Reese, Snapper Reese, the guy in charge of the operation, stopped him and said, I'm going in.
Oh, it's my responsibility. Yes. Okay. Yeah.
So Henry Reese, this 25-year-old Welsh coal miner, he goes in and the fuse went out.
Sure.
You know, it was spliced together how many different places. It went out. So Reese is like, all right, I got to resplice it and I'll relight it. So he's looking for a penknife. He doesn't have one. So fortunately, another lieutenant's coming by from Schuylkill Haven, Jacob Dowdy. He's a boilermaker, and he said, I got a knife for you. Together, they resplice it, and they relight it, and then they turned, and they got out. They got out, you know, and they said, it'll be a matter of minutes now, so let's watch. And then apparently it was 4:44 a.m., and the ground began to tremble underground, and it was like a muffled sound when suddenly the earth just opened up. It just opened up, you know, just this massive explosion. And it literally blasted a hole in the Confederate lines. I mean, it opened it up, 150 feet gap, 30 feet deep, 40 feet wide. They have just destroyed an entire battery. About 300 Confederate soldiers are killed instantly. Mm-hmm. Many are smothered to death with the falling debris and dirt. But my goodness, it worked. You know, the 48th Pennsylvania, this regiment from Schuylkill County, have just blasted a hole in the line. And what is Henry Pleasance thinking watching this? You know, what are his soldiers thinking? You know, this is going to be the attack that breaks the
quote-unquote
siege of Petersburg, right? So, I mean, I can only imagine their thoughts when 5, 6, 10 minutes later, Ledley's guys go in, and they go right in. They go right
into the hole.
And it's so deep they can't even get out. You know, they begin to put bayonets in the side as ladders to try to... And they see, you know, arms and legs of Confederate soldiers buried in the earth, and they began to extract them, you know, from this, you know, devastating thing. And the Union artillery opened fire at the same time. There's 100-plus guns that Henry Hunt is now bombarding the rest of the Confederate line with.
Hell yeah, Henry Hunt.
You got a boom, I got a boom. Time to go.
So, I mean, this is and how do the Confederates know this is the only mine? You know, so what if there's two? What if there's three, you know? So Confederates in other parts of the line got a little shaky, naturally, because of what just happened.
Right.
But now the attack is just, they go into the crater. And the Ninth Corps just, they began to funnel guys. They tried to extend the trenches. It's remarkable how fast the Confederates rallied, you know, in this. We know what happened, you know. We know it resulted in a complete disaster for the Union and the Ninth Corps. And Burnside, you know, several times, you know, Robert E. Lee has stripped most of his right flank to plug this gap, this literal hole in the line. There's very little opposing Warren in the Fifth Corps. You know, Warren was next to the Ninth Corps.
Mm-hmm.
There was very little to his front, just a few skeletal brigades. But there's no other attack. There's no, I mean, it seems by 9 a.m. George Meade is just leaving Burnside in the Ninth Corps to the, you know, and he tells him at that point, it's done. It's over. It's 9 o'clock. And you can wait till dark to extract yourself. And it's 9 o'clock in the morning.
John, this makes me mad. As you talk, I'm like, I want to go punch George Meade in the face. I want to punch this engineer in the face. It's like, you guys did nothing to assist in this. And for a moment... it was the most majestic and powerful thing to happen physically in the war, and it worked.
It worked.
Like, you bastards. Like, I want to add it to the list of things to time travel when we mess with the paradox. Like, I'm going to go handle this one.
Well, you know, and George Meade, you know, he never had faith in it. Grant seemingly never really had faith in it.
Which is interesting because he had a mine operation at Vicksburg.
He did.
So,
But, I mean...
it didn't work there real great there.
But. Absolutely. But here, I mean, it was very obvious.
Right.
There is utter confusion. There is chaos going on in the Confederate lines right now. I mean, it's one of the great what-ifs. You know, what if Gouverneur Warren had been ordered to advance... but apparently, as Burnside began to formulate his plans a few weeks earlier, he had written a note to Meade, you know, saying, well, at this point is when, you know, the Fifth Corps could enter. And Meade took so offense to that. He's like, let me remind you that I'm the Army commander. You don't tell when the Fifth Corps attacks.
Oh.
You know, so this whole, you know, George Meade kind of, mm-hmm. you know, I'm the Army commander. I get to delegate when the Fifth Corps, if they attack, when they attack, not you. You know, so this whole independent command kind of situation,
I hate,
you know, going on there.
I hate when you can tell a pissing match, even like 160 plus years after it happened. It's like, that's annoying, George.
Well,
that's
George, so annoying. There's a court of inquiry, of course, for the failure. Right. And George Meade, you know, he stacked the court. It's Nelson Miles. It's his people. And, of course, every Ninth Corps had rolled. And some fittingly, of course, sure. Ledley's gone.
Yeah.
He should be gone. Yeah. Ferraro's gone. But, you know, they blame Burnside.
Yeah, you gotta blame the guy that was ready for the fight. Yeah, the guy that didn't get to do it and was ready, you're fired.
Well, they blamed him especially for not supplying or not giving scaling ladders to the soldiers in their, or not sending forward pioneers to break up the abattis in front of the Confederate lines. I mean, this is what they're getting Burnside on.
Hmm.
And Burnside's like, well, if I had sent forward pioneers, they would know exactly where the attack's going to be.
Yeah. Right. Also, I'd have no more pioneers because they'd be dead.
So,
like, what?
The court of inquiry was, it was a farce, and everyone knew it. And Grant told Burnside to take a leave, and he did, and he never came back.
Right.
And John Park will assume command of the Ninth Corps. The Committee on the Conduct of the War, though, wasn't letting Meade off the hook.
Right.
Of course, they're not a fan of George Meade at all.
Right.
In Washington, so they summon a committee, and they investigate this fiasco of the mine. And Henry Pleasance is all too happy to testify in front of Congress, and he does not hold back. It's George Meade who failed. George Meade let me down. He let the Army down. George Meade is 100% responsible for this loss, and Grant, too. So the Committee on the Conduct of the War basically praises Pleasant, saying, you did everything right.
Yeah.
Your guys did everything right. George Meade is to blame for this fiasco of the crater. But the Committee on the Conduct of the War had no pull militarily.
Right. Yeah,
so. I hope Pleasant's made direct eye contact with somebody in Meade's camp the whole time he shit on him. He's just like, you know what? He's like, you know what, dude? You are, it's you. It's your fault. It's your fault.
So I understand that Grant was pulled in front of the Joint Committee on the Conduct of the War as well to
right.
testify.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually does agree with Meade's decision in regards to Ferraro's division.
Right.
He thinks that's he understands what's happening, or I guess his testimony basically says he understands Burnside's mindset. Mm-hmm. He appreciates that he did the special training and,
right.
and the preparation,
mm-hmm.
but he agreed with Meade's analysis
yes.
that this would look terrible. And I can't really disagree
right.
with him on that.
Yeah, and Meade Grant might have said it best when he wrote it was the saddest affair of the war.
Right,
and,
exactly.
That's probably the best way to describe it.
Yeah. Because some of those USCTs do go in.
They do go in, yes. They do go in, and they perform well
mm-hmm.
In combat there. And, of course, things just got bitter.
Yeah.
Things just got full of hate. The Ninth Corps loses, I think, 40 or 50% of the killed in the Ninth Corps USCT soldiers,
mm-hmm.
Even though they weren't engaged as long
heavily,
as the other
yeah.
units. It was a sad affair.
I read a statistic about the crater just recently where you guys know it's usually like 5 to 8 men wounded per
yeah.
one killed, and it's almost 2 to 1 in the sense of the USCT that engage
yeah.
at the crater. It's
right.
like 1.6 guys wounded versus 1 killed.
Yeah.
It,
mm-hmm.
It's that close because there is some post-fighting execution
right.
of the USCT
mm-hmm.
here. It's bad.
It's grisly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so just a horrific event. And, you know, studying the 48th, being from Schuylkill County, I couldn't help but imagine what they were thinking during
right.
all of this. You know, they spent a month underground. It worked. But then just
what?
Like that.
Exactly.
So for you, who is not only passionate about the subject, obviously professionally, but like you're from this area. Like this is like your personal heritage. Like,
right.
like
your people.
You have miners in your family. You're from this part of the state. You know, it's like the first time you physically went down there, because I'm going to assume you've been to the crater.
I have, yes.
What was that moment like for you?
I was stunned with how close the lines were.
Yeah.
I mean, it really, truly seemed to me that I could have someone in the crater and I could talk to him at the entrance of the mine. I mean, it just seemed to me to be so, so very close.
Yeah.
And I thought, how did they ever pull this off?
Hmm.
You know, how did they ever do this? But Henry Reese, after the war, he wrote, he said, you know, had I known what a disaster, would I never would have relit that fuse, you know.
Oh, so, that's interesting. He would have just let the operation fail. Huh? Yep.
A lot more lives would have been saved. Right. But definitely. I mean, how do you know?
Yeah.
And how,
how do you know?
I mean, at that moment, it was, this is what's going to break this deadlock here in Petersburg. And it should have, you know.
It definitely should. So that's why I said I'm, like, mad. It's like, this should have worked. I mean, everything that needed to work other than the human element, like the jackassery in charge, for lack of a better description, it's like, we got into this, like, pissing match. We got into this whatever. But it's like, the mine was dug. The fuses were, I'm sorry, the galleries were packed, magazines were packed, fuses laid, it goes, like, it all works. The only thing that didn't work was the post-attack, and the post-attack didn't work because you removed the people ready for it. And, like, worst time to start winging it.
Yeah, and, like, and, you know, shame on Burnside for using drawing straws to choose who led the attack, you know.
Yeah, that is that's kind of on a him. Weird move. Yeah, that's on a him. Really weird that is move. On
him. And, but otherwise, you know, he did have faith in the operation. But just, you know, to wrap up the 48th story, Pleasance did testify. He was out of the army after that. He could not return.
So is that the war for them? Like, right here at the crater? No, like, is the 48th, did they go to Appomattox?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
But we oftentimes think it's the end.
No. I mean, that's personally like what I thought, too. I was like, is this the end of the story?
No, the 48th remained in the trenches of Petersburg, and they probably mocked when Confederates reoccupied the crater and incorporated it into their defensive lines, you know. But they shifted south. They were at Peebles Farm. They suffered a good number of men captured there at Peebles Farm. And April 2nd of 1865 was their last major battle. And George Gowan is struck and killed, leading the men against Fort Hell or Fort Mahone.
Really?
Yep. So he is struck squarely in the head with a cannonball.
That'll do it.
And they lose a lot of men there. Yeah, so George Gowan took over command of the 48th after Henry Pleasance left after the crater. And
are we talking like the first scene of glory? Like, it was
pretty brutal, apparently, because Samuel Bedall of Company E was carrying the flag at that point. And he was next to him.
Oh my goodness!
And he wrote, you know, about the flag just getting covered with George Gowan's blood, lifeblood, and all that.
When people just casually say, like, and it's so in our line of work, it's pretty regular, but like, just struck in the head with a cannonball, it's like, no, your head is gone. You're not, like, struck with a bullet that left a hole out. Like, your head's gone.
Yeah, and they lost. And, you know, I think about these soldiers so much. Because we know a week later what happens. You know, they don't know that, of course, on April 2nd. But the 48th loses, again, a good number of men during this final battle of the war. They attack Fort Mahone. They drive back AP Hill's line there. There is a monument to the 48th at Petersburg, and with Gowan on top. So I don't know if you're familiar with it, but
I've never been there personally.
There at the side of Fort Mahone, where Gowan was killed. It's a really cool monument. It's a neat monument, but it's completely surrounded with a development. So
of course it is.
It is literally an island with a monument on it, surrounded by, I know there's a tire shop there, there's fast food. It's just completely engulfed.
Well, this Gowan can get a bite to eat, get his car fixed now. Pretty easy, right?
Well, yeah, he is laid to rest in Germantown. His brother then, of course, went on to lead the prosecution of the Molly Maguires. Henry Pleasance returned to Pottsville to his young wife from Lexington, Kentucky, and he became the head of the Coal and Iron Police. So the Pennsylvania Railroads have a police force. Mm-hmm. And what is their job?
Yeah.
But to quell labor uprisings.
Yeah, strike breaker.
And who are the men leading the labor uprisings post-war but coal miners? So I have to imagine that at some point in time, Henry Pleasance was leading the Coal and Iron Police against some of the guys he commanded and who helped dig that tunnel at Petersburg. Oh,
that's just tragic.
You know?
That's
a tragic irony. He was 47 years old when he died. He had a brain tumor, and it was incurable. Traveled to Europe. They thought they could treat it there, but he died very young at age 47.
Oh, my goodness.
So he's buried there in Pottsville. And Noggle's buried in Pottsville, the guy who organized this regiment originally. But they are mustered out of service July 17th of 1865. So they were in existence for almost 4 years, from August 61 to July of 65. They traveled many thousands of miles by foot, by rail, by boat, Tennessee, Kentucky, Virginia, Maryland, North Carolina. You know, some of their men are buried at Andersonville. some at Salisbury, North Carolina. So, yeah, they're dead or buried in seven states. And it's just a Ninth Corps unit that saw an awful lot of this war, you know, in different theaters.
Mm-hmm. I'm impressed by a lot of things. First of all, thank you so much for that story. That was incredible. But, like, the amount of individuals by name that you have no notes in front of you. I like you. Exactly. So the people that don't see this, because this is not on our YouTube, like, there are no notes on the table right now. And you just drew all of that out of your brain. All those names, all those, you know, recountings, whatever, atmospheric, just reminiscences. Like, oh my goodness. Like, I'm just impressed by that. That was phenomenal.
John's very humble, but you've done a book on South Mountain, but also the 48th, though, correct?
Yeah, I edited a series of letters from a lieutenant in the 48th.
Gotcha.
Thank you for that. But I have spent a good amount of my time trying to get to know these people as people, not as soldiers.
Right.
Mm. And you read about them and you discover, you know, they're human beings.
Yeah.
You know, there were so many guys after the war who sadly did not live long after the war. There was a soldier, last name Clemens, who is discharged in July of 65. He served the entire 4 years. He survived every battle. He's killed in a coal mine collapse 3 months later when he's back at home working. There was Charles Lindenmuth from Company I, who was shot in the face at Spotsylvania, developed pneumonia, could not get a pension. He could not get a pension, and he was probably the only soldier who could not. And he tried to take his own life. He slit his throat on the GAR floor in Pottsville in 1891. Because he couldn't support his family anymore. And a lot of these guys after the war, they're struggling, you know, they're suffering. And it's part of the Civil War story that we oftentimes don't think about. It ends in 65 in so many of our minds. But what happened to these 22, 23, 24-year-old guys when they return home?
Yeah, they're still young men.
They are. And not only that, but they're paying their respects at local cemeteries to their friends, you know, that... They were still in the army when they were laid to rest, you know, in these local graveyards back at home, you know. So, you know, you try to think about what did they experience after the war. But the 48th Pennsylvania's last surviving soldier passed away in August of 1941. And, he made it 99 years, something like that. But he was their last survivor, 1941. And that's where the last living remnant of the 48th Pennsylvania left.
What's neat about that is, like, the longevity of it. What I always find sad about that is, like, you live long enough to see the world lose its mind twice.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Absolutely lose its mind twice. Like, when my great-grandfather passed away, he died the month after 9/11. And, like, we always talk about it. It's like, man, he lived long enough just to see the city he built our family in come under attack. Yeah, and it's like, I get that same thought right now. It's like, that's awesome that he lived that long. But it's like, dude, that sucks that you got to see, like, literally both the world wars, like, one in its totality and another one begin. And but
there's a handful that see the extent of both.
There's some cool themes. Like, you know, we are fortunate because this is what we do for a living, to, like, study this and talk about it all the time. But, like, we're talking about Petersburg things that sound like the Western Front. You know, I was thinking about all the – you talked about the reenlistment period for this unit, right, and all these fresh – guys, and I was getting, like, very July 1st, 1916 Somme vibes. Yeah. It's like the first thing you do in the war is the first day on the Somme. Like, we know how that goes. Mm-hmm. So similarly, it's like some of the first things you do blood-wise in the war are Battle of Spotsylvania Courthouse. Like, holy moly.
Right.
And I, you know, can try and disconnect that story more. I talked about William Almond fighting in the Spanish-American War. Oliver Bosby's son, Shell. Oliver Bosby Shell's son, Charles Bosby Shell, is killed in World War I as a major in the U.S., I think, Air Force.
Oh, my goodness.
And he lived long enough to know that, you know, that his son had died in combat.
He lived long enough to see flight happen, though.
Yeah. Like, that's cool. And you think about that, too. I mean, Civil War veterans watched Wizard of Oz. You know?
Kind of
a weird thing.
Oh, man. Nobody's ever said that to me before. Yeah. You just made my mind explode.
Yeah. I mean, it's just an amazing thing. And, you know, I tell that, you know, to students especially who think that history is so long ago and no longer relevant. It's, you know, no, that we're still feeling history. And, you know, I've had the good fortune to meet 10 grandchildren of Civil War soldiers. And it's just, it just happened, you know.
Like grandchildren.
Yeah, like, not great,
like,
great.
Not like grandchildren.
Like,
yeah.
Not like the way we say great, but we leave off the like the X, like I'm like the 5X grandchild.
I remember one man especially during the 150th of Antietam back in 2012. He came to the front desk. He was, I believe, he was born in 1928, so he would have been, let's see, 72 plus 12 is 84. And he wanted to see where his grandfather fought with the 9th New York, the Hawkins Wabs. And, you know, not thinking, I said, oh, you mean your great-grandfather? He said, oh, no, this was my grandfather. Let me tell you about
it. He'd had that reaction before.
Yeah, so he was born, I think, 1928, and his grandfather passed away in 1939. And he spent the first 11 years of his life in the same house.
When did the last Civil War confirm veteran?
I believe 1953.
Dude, that's the year my dad was born.
Yeah.
Like, that's my wild. Mother. Like, I mean, but like, think about that. Like, my dad was born the same year Civil War soldiers were on the planet.
Right.
Yep.
Like, that's crazy.
Yeah, I believe it's 53.
Oh, man. John, I'm so pumped.
John, before we wrap this up, I'm going to keep tooting your horn, my friend, because you've done some work with the monuments there at Antietam, too. And. Mm-hmm. Noggle's monument, right? Mm-hmm. Tell that story, because that's a great one.
You made Noggle's monument?
No.
You're fantastic.
No. It was pointed out, and it hit me that the sword that was once on Noggle's side was gone. And I worked with the park to get it back on there. So
You downplay that so much, but it's important to do.
I know somebody that works in their maintenance division. I hope you made that person who goes by their initials do it personally. So wink, wink to my friend if you know I'm talking about you.
No, it's on there, and I'm happy about that. In 2010, it was replaced. And,
very cool.
Yeah, I had some descendants of James Noggle there. I invited them up. That's fantastic.
Very neat, man. I love this. Like, we've had, as you look over at the wall, we're going to have you sign in a minute here. Like, we've had the good fortune of having some incredible storytellers on this show, and they've all been impressive. But I got to admit, man, the no notes, like, that entire story from a lack of notation in front of you was just, I am mystified by that, and I am in awe, and I thank you for that. Couple quick things on my end that are almost completely unrelated to this, but I like to just connect the world. We did talk about you and I meeting at the 152nd and battle anniversary hike in Antietam, and we're both Yankees fans. And I did want to tell you that, I don't know, you probably won't remember this. It's a long time ago, and a lot of life has occurred. But my favorite thing about that day was, like I am right now, I'm wearing a Yankees hat. I was wearing a Yankee hat this day, and I think we started obviously over in the cornfield, and we were walking back towards the visitor center, towards one of the stops, and you pulled me aside and said, are you a Yankee fan? And I said, yeah, well, absolutely. And you went, me too. And I think you would notice me looking at my phone every couple of minutes, and you were like, are you watching the game? And I was like, yes. And you were like, can you keep me updated? So for like unofficially, like off and on during the day, I'd be like, it's 2-1 Yankees, top six, two out. And I love that. I was like, that was such a cool thing. Like, I'm having this great day at one of my favorite battlefield sites, and I met this really cool Ranger, fantastic storyteller. Another takeaway from that day for me was you talking about Lee, you know, throwing punches when we were standing by the Pennsylvania Monument over there by the Philadelphia Brigade. But it was just, that was such a special day for me on the journey to what I do now, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I do this job as a Ranger, so it was a hell of a thing. How'd you end up as a Yankees fan? Gotta ask, you know, you grew up in Philadelphia Phillies country.
Yeah, I did. And actually, when I was a young kid playing Little League, I wanted to be a baseball player when I was a kid, but it turns out I'm not that good.
Yeah, me too, buddy.
But I played Little League, and in 1988 or 89, Chris Sabo was a rookie. He was a third baseman for the Reds. And I felt it, I don't know why, you know, kind of connection to this Chris Sabo guy.
Yeah.
So I wore number 17 on my Little League team.
Okay.
And my mom got tickets for me to go to Veterans Stadium in Philly when the Reds were in town one weekend. And, boy, she even found out what hotel they were in the days before the internet.
Wow.
So there I was as an 11-year-old with the Cincinnati Reds team. So I got Barry Larkin and Jose Rijo, and I was in the elevator with Chris Sabo. So he was at the bar after a game. It was a game where he hit two home runs. And
so he was having a good time.
He was having a good time after the game. So I was in the lobby with my sister, and I saw Chris Sabo go in. He grabbed two beers. He came out. He grabbed the elevator. So my sister and I ducked on the elevator with him. And I thought, this is my moment. Okay, I got to say something. So I turn around as a young kid, and, you know, I had a speech impediment at the time, and I said, you know, Mr. Sabo, I just want to tell you I'm a big fan of yours. He goes, oh, thanks. He goes, so why you root for me? You should be a Phillies fan. I'm like, oh. So I was crushed. But, you know, nice enough guy. But that was also the same series where Paul O'Neill in right field kicked the ball to the second baseman.
Yes.
And I continued to watch the Reds until Paul O'Neill left.
Got traded.
So then I went back to the Yankees because the very first baseball game I ever went to was Yankee Stadium. So I think it was 86. And I was 8 years old, and my sister and I went up. We loved Don Mattingly.
Yes, Donnie Baseball.
We actually got poster boards, and we just made number 23 rules. And I had a wallpaper border that we rolled out and wrote Don Mattingly rules on it. We went to watch him at old Yankee Stadium, and my parents, they knew where the player's entrance was.
Yeah.
So we went there to watch the players come in. I got autographs of the mid-'80s Yankees, and they were pretty terrible.
They were. Minus Donnie, they were pretty terrible.
Yeah, so Don Mattingly, you know, we were there. And so this was my introduction, and I'll never forget the moment when you walk out and you see a baseball field for the first time.
Yeah.
You know, when you walk out from the, and they're like, wow, there it is.
Yeah.
On the way home from that game, no lie, my sister is in the car. She turns around and says, Don Mattingly's behind us. I'm like, yeah, right. Sure enough, I turn around. Don Mattingly's driving the red sports car out of Yankee Stadium.
Yeah.
And instead of appreciating the moment and watching, I hold up this giant poster board I made against the window. So I missed him entirely. You know, I just wanted to see. So it began with Don Mattingly in the early 80s. It returned with Paul O'Neill in the mid-90s.
You are the man. Man, that's so funny. I encountered Bryce Harper once leaving Nationals Park, and it was its own story, which I'll tell someday. But it's you did the right thing, showing him the love. Because Donnie Baseball, man, having left in 95 and then winning the World Series in 90, maybe Gods and Generals is Ted Turner's revenge, because he owned the Braves at that time. And he was like, you know what I'll do? I'll make this movie that just pisses on the Yankees, but not those Yankees, different Yankees. maybe nobody will get it. Who knows? But it was just something that I wanted to ask you for many years, because obviously I didn't know you, and I don't presume to know you now, but I'm acquainted through what we do professionally and through Matt's. But I was like, you know what? The more we get to know each other, I'm eventually going to ask, how the hell did you end up in Pinstripes? Because like me, like I'm not from New York. Like my dad is the New Yorker, so that's how I came to him. But I got goosebumps when you talked about seeing the infield and like the grass for the first time. Yeah. Like I remember that. I never forget that moment.
And also, you know, being, you know, so, I mean, history, you know, there's, you know, so much history with the Yankees.
Well, the house that Ruth built itself, right? Oh, man. So, John, when we do our history of baseball episode, you want to come back?
Because we're going
to
be doing it.
I don't know if I can do current day, you know, because as with everything with me, anything past like 1996, you know, is kind of like
fuzzy.
Yeah.
Well, have you hung around for the rest of those Yankees World Series in the 90s? Yeah, not just the 96 one. The 98 one was pretty special. But well, so then you're probably not hip to the historic contract that was just signed the other day, are you?
I'm aware of it.
$700 million to play the game of baseball? We won't get into that, but like, you know, by the time this comes out, that's old, old news. But as we were recording this, it's kind of happening, and the young boy in me that would have played baseball for free in any, even the, I would have played for the Red Sox if I could have played Major League Baseball. It's like $700 million. Jeez. So,
well, I tell you what, I mean, I really enjoyed just talking 48th. And
yeah, that was awesome, dude. Thank you so much.
The thing is with Civil War, at least as far as I'm concerned, is, you know, I just really, I want to know who these people were as people. And because, you know, they made the history, you know, they you know, this is the war that, you know, just in my estimation was the single most important moment, you know, in American history is, will this country work, you know, and, you know, just to be caught up in that. I try to imagine, you know, coal miners going to work, students going to school, and all of a sudden this happens.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And just the response, the reaction, and after 160 years, we're still talking about it.
100%.
You know, yes.
You know,
yep. 100%.
So in depth and thousands of books, you know.
How many of those thousands have you written?
Oh, not many. Not many.
Do you have a website? Do you have, like, where can people find your work? Like,
well, I have a blog on the 48th Pennsylvania.
You want to shout that out?
If you'd like.
Yes,
yeah,
back in the
year 2007, I was getting acquainted with technology and, you know, I like to tell my daughter, I said, you know, I didn't even have an email address until I got to college. You know, kind of just mind-blowing. And now she knows, you know, how to do all this stuff. But in 2007, I launched a blog dedicated to the 48th.
Okay.
And I try to tell as many stories as I can. And I was very active on it for the first, like, 10, 12 years. But then I kind of ran out of stories to tell on one regiment. So every now and then I will update it. But the wonderful thing about that is I did not expect this, but I have been contacted by so many descendants of 48th Pennsylvania soldiers who are willing to share their letters, ancestors' letters, photographs of their ancestor, and they're willing for me to share the photo and tell their story.
That's awesome.
Incredible.
Yeah, so on there you'll find, I mentioned those 150-plus photos, they're all on there. So I just try to tell as many stories as I can.
What's the name of the blog, John?
It's 48thpennsylvania.blogspot.com. So
yeah, Blogspot. You were on the original Blogspot.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I still have a Hotmail email account, too.
Dude, so nice. That is old school. Hotmail, I don't even think exists anymore. I think Outlook's like, you got to change that.
I think I got that email saying I need to change it soon.
You got to change that. So. Well, look, man. John, well, come back. You're welcome on our show anytime. Matt
Absolutely.
And I always extend the offer to come back, talk about any Civil War topic you want, but also this. We all have the worlds we live in professionally, but you might be passionate about something completely outside of the box. Any story you want to tell, you are welcome back to sit behind these microphones and share it with our listeners, because we're all better off for it. So thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Guys, season 5 is rolling. If you're not ready for this yet, the tone has been set. We literally came out of the coal mines. We're covered in absolute crap. We got coal dust. We got mud on us now at this point. That one's not super new. Matt and I, again, World War I mud, we're familiar with. But we're in it. We're just so in it. So we hope you stick around. St. Paddy's Day is coming up. Once again, our yearly opening of the History Things Tavern is ahead of you. So I hope you guys have been eating a good pre-base food, because it's going to get... We're going to get a little silly, and you're going to feel it the next day. So we hope you guys have had a really good time listening to this episode of the History Things podcast. John, thank you so very much again for
joining us. It's been amazing,
sir.
Thank you.
So for our guest today, John Hontak, author, historian, and park ranger, just like our co-host with the most across from me. That's how I introduce Matt. For our co-host, Matt Borders, I'm your co-host, Pat McGuire. This has been the History Things podcast, and we'll catch you all later.
Have a good night.